Yeah, don't worry. There will be more. Because as we all know, the number 3 in the Web3 stands for the minimum amount of middlemen involved in each interaction.
Wait, what? So you can trade all these shitty impersonator tokens, but you cannot trade the original legit token? Really? Nice.
But it gets even worse because Privy got acquired by Stripe, which is a huge and obviously fully compliant US-based corporation.
And so look at crypto now. Fucking KYC everywhere. Custodial wallets, tons of middlemen and other parasites.
You literally cannot pay with Ether for a ticket to one of the largest Ethereum events.
Wanna be bankless? Fine, then be fucking bankless.
And since they acknowledge that, then they have to admit that Bitcoin is the oldest meme coin.
Because it's a fucking war. It's not peacetime, man. Wake up.
For example, so many people think that it's mathematically impossible to seize their Bitcoins, or that there can never be more than 21 million Bitcoin.
Wait, so Block 8 blacklisted us for impersonating a malicious token, which was actually impersonating us. Oh man, I fucking love all this crypto shit. It's like that famous Spider-Man meme, you know?
Man, I'm damn serious. It was Twitter, Google, and Bitly. And that's basically PSE in a nutshell.
Ah, Farcaster. I have a slogan for them. Farcaster, made by slaves for slaves.
Yep, that's another good point. So the Ethereum community feeds the beast that seeks to destroy it.
Well, how about this? If you want people to develop freedom tech, then treat them as free men, and not as fucking slaves. That would be my suggestion to the Ethereum Foundation.
It's the long-awaited Web3 future. It's the Web3 dream, which, like morning mist, fades with the first light of dawn, leaving you alone, surrounded by the wolves. You thought you were hiding in the dark forest, but it was the same old slave tech, dressed in Web3 clothing. Okay, so it's happening.
It is.
Great. We've been thinking about it for a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
So, how do you want to kickstart all of this?
Well, let's play intro.
But we don't have any intro.
Said who?
Wait, did you make an intro?
I surely did.
Okay, then fire it up.
Dark Vegas Tales, the most hardcore Lunar Punk shit talking.
That was amazing.
I knew you were gonna fucking love it.
Okay. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hell no.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. Okay, so let's jump into our topic today.
Let's do it.
So, should we have a proper structure? And maybe a list of issue we want to talk about?
Nah. Let's just rage. Isn't that the whole point? Just say what you want without thinking.
Okay. Then you go first.
Sure. Welcome to Lunapunk Shit Talking Show. In this very first episode, we're gonna talk about Ethereum and why 99% of Ethereum fanboys are solar punk cocksuckers.
Great. What a beginning. Do you think we will get canceled by Ethereum guys after this?
I think we are already canceled by everybody.
Okay, yeah, you're right. So I guess, let me do my rage then. I've started actively approaching the Ethereum community about a year ago, trying to onboard them to Spasm forums, and I was not able to even start a conversation.
What do you mean?
Well, I've checked all major Ethereum projects, and they are only using slave tech. It's insane. The situation is even worse than in the Monero and broader privacy community. It's all Twitter, Discord, Telegram, and Reddit. Basically, slave tech platforms controlled by corporations without any privacy.
Wait, so do you think it's somewhat better in the so-called privacy community?
Not much, to be honest. But in the privacy community, people at least sometimes list options that I can use. For example, many privacy influencers provide a PGP pub key and an email address, which is an extremely outdated method of communication, but I can at least use it.
Oh, come on. Emails are the same slave tech, and you know that. We talked about that multiple times. The vast majority of people don't run their own email server, but instead use third-party email services like Proton, Tutanota, or even fucking Gmail.
Yeah, I know. By the way, I remember seeing that early Nostr Git commits were made by its founder Fiat Jaff from a Gmail account. That was pretty eye-opening. Anyway, even though emails are obviously slave tech, you can at least encrypt a message with a PGP key and send it over Tor.
But can you easily register a new email address using Tor?
Well, that one is harder, for sure. I just had a conversation about emails the other day. There was an amazing dark web email service called Elude, which allowed users to create an email address over Tor and then activate it by sending a bit of Monero to a custodial wallet. It's sad they chose to exit scam.
You can register a horse fucker address.
Yes, Cockly is a good option with many funny domains, but they were also down a long time. I think they opened registration again, but I definitely remember not being able to use the service when I needed an email address.
Yeah, that's the thing with emails. You can only use them one time if you want to keep your privacy. You cannot reuse any of your addresses. That's a major problem with emails.
You can use email aliases to hide your primary address.
Are you serious? That shit is for privacy teenagers on YouTube.
Well, I'm kind of playing devil's advocate now. Do you mind explaining for listeners what's wrong with email aliases?
Ah, got it. Excusez-moi. So the short answer is email aliases are shit. The slightly longer answer is that your email aliases provider knows everything about you, so there is no privacy whatsoever. You may be hide your real email address from a local business, but the easiest solution is to simply use fake email addresses when filling random forms. Always write some bullshit in the email field, and be creative and funny. The same goes for a phone number and address fields. Basically, just don't be a compliant pussy.
Yeah, fake email addresses are great. But what do you do when you actually need to receive or send a legit email?
Just don't do it. Resist slave tech as much as possible. And if you absolutely need to use an email, for example, to attend some cocksucker's event, then use Cockly. It's great and works most of the time. And you can also register a Proton email over Tor using one of the temporary email services.
Proton? I thought you were one of those people who never uses Proton and instead call it a honeypot.
Of course, Proton is a honeypot. Every email service is a fucking honeypot. Whether it's Cockly or Proton or Disroot or any other email service, every single one of them is a honeypot. It's an account-based centralized service controlled by one officially registered compliant entity that already fully leaked this database or will leak it soon.
Okay, so how do you register Proton over Tor?
Yeah, so open Proton Onion address and sign up for a free account until you will be prompted to confirm your another email address. Then search for one-time email services or temporary email. There are a bunch of them and try to get an activation code. Keep in mind, though, that it doesn't work all the time, but most such services frequently rotate domain names because they always get blocked by Proton and other websites, so keep trying. If it didn't work, then wait for a few hours and try again from a different Tor identity. Ideally, you want to register enough email addresses and save credentials in a password manager so you don't have to worry about them when you actually need one, and avoid using emails as much as possible. Leave it to slaves.
Okay, so let me repeat for those who can't understand your thick accent.
What accent are you talking about?
Whatever. So if I need an email address, I firstly try to register a new email address at Cockly. If that doesn't work, then I open a Proton Onion address in one tab and some temporary email in another tab and try to receive an activation code to unlock my new Proton account. Is that correct?
No.
Why?
Because you should never use emails. It's for cocksuckers, ha ha.
I'm not trying to defend emails here, but you can at least run your own email server.
You can, but most people don't. Besides, the majority of TechCV users don't run email server at home, but rather rent it from a hosting provider, which is a centralized compliant business. Moreover, emails rely on centralized DNS, cause nobody gonna send an email to your IP address. And your domain name can easily be seized the same as your server.
Okay, I think we should move on. What I was trying to say is that in the privacy community, it's at least a common practice to provide a PGP key in the contacts section, while in the Ethereum ecosystem, that doesn't happen even when you search in its Lunar Punk corners, like the Web3 privacy community or a privacy branch of Ethereum Foundation.
I'm not sure that listing a PGP key is much better, since that legitimizes a very, very outdated and completely not private method of communication, but whatever. Let's move on. What else did you notice?
So another thing I've noticed is that in the privacy community, many people use Matrix.
But Matrix is shit.
Wait. I know that Matrix is shit, but it is at least better than Telegram and Discord, right?
Well, I mean, kind of, yeah, you can say so. Actually, I'm taking my words back. In 2025, Matrix is not better than Telegram, Discord, or even fucking WhatsApp.
Why is that?
Well, because Matrix gives you a wrong impression that you're using some privacy-focused freedom tech, which is even more dangerous. It's a false sense of security. It's like those privacy apps on Apple devices that give people a false feeling that they can achieve privacy while using Apple. That's bullshit.
Okay, that's a valid statement. I still think that Matrix has a much better architecture than Telegram or Discord. But you're right that it gives a false sense of security or privacy, and that's a problem. Should we talk about Matrix in more details in this episode?
Nah, fuck Matrix. Let's not waste our time on outdated tech. We can review Matrix and other messaging apps in a separate episode.
Yeah. Let's keep that discussion for a separate episode. I would still say that the privacy and Monero community is a bit more conscious, because they're at least trying to get more privacy and decentralization by using Matrix.
Fine. I don't care. What's next?
So another good thing I've noticed is that some privacy influencers started listing Simple X Contact. And I think there was one guy with a session account. It's interesting though, because it seems like most people are divided into either Simple X or Session Camp.
Yeah, that's some tribal bullshit. People do that all the time. It's called holy wars.
Exactly. I've tried chatting with some people, and most of them never researched architectures or these two very different messaging apps, so they don't really understand pros and cons of each product.
Let me guess. SimpleX fanboys complain that Session doesn't have perfect forward secrecy, and Session fanboys complain that SimpleX is centralized as fuck.
Pretty much, yeah. Although that's not it. I think many SimpleX users like the idea that you can run your own infrastructure.
But they don't do it. You can just open any SimpleX chat and see that most people there use default centralized services.
Yeah, correct. Most people use default servers, which can identify them using network-level identifiers like IP addresses and correlate timestamps, but that's a long discussion. Very few people use their own servers, but then they stand out from the crowd, which defeats the purpose.
Aren't they partnering with another server operator to fix that?
Well, kind of. They started working with Flux Server Operator, but that's still pretty centralized.
Interesting. Anyway, should we go back to talking about the Ethereum community?
Yeah, let's do that. So I would suggest that for this episode, let's assume that both Session and SimpleX are somewhat privacy-focused and sufficiently decentralized solutions. While Matrix is pretty bad, but it's at least better than Telegram, Discord, and Signal. And we can talk more about these apps in future episodes.
Sounds good to me. Let's move on. So Ethereum.
Oh, wait. I forgot about Nostr. That was another positive thing I've noticed in the privacy community. More and more people started listing their Nostr accounts in the last few years, and even some Monero people do that nowadays. Even though Nostr was historically a Bitcoin maxi project.
Okay, that's cool. Noster's a pretty good solution. Have you seen any Ethereum people using Noster?
None. I mean, I'm sure that some people in the Ethereum ecosystem use Noster, but I haven't seen any major Ethereum project linking a Noster account. As I said, they only list legacy slave apps like Twitter, Telegram, or Discord.
Is it that bad?
Well, to be fair, some projects also list Ethereum-based solutions like Lens, Mirror, or Farcaster. And I also saw a few Blue Sky accounts.
Ah, Farcaster. I have a slogan for them. Farcaster, made by slaves for slaves.
Nice. It fits them pretty good, but let's be honest, Lens, Mirror, or Blue Sky are not much better than Farcaster.
That's true. Although, you should probably elaborate on that for people who don't have enough knowledge in this field.
You're right. But that would take the whole episode. Let's focus on Ethereum for now. I will just mention that all of those alternative social media solutions are closed ecosystems without any future. And there is a section in the Spasm docs that compares Spasm with other solutions in more details.
Okay, that's fair. So what was the overall response when you were pitching Spasm to Ethereum folks?
To be honest, silence. That was the most common response I got. Silence? Crickets.
Nice.
Although, as I said, I was not even able to start a conversation with most of the projects because they only use slave tech apps.
Yeah, I got it. But did you manage to contact major players?
I did, mostly through unencrypted plain text emails. I was able to contact big guys like Ethereum Foundation and also tried smaller guys, mainly various Ethereum event organizers like ETH Global or Web3 Privacy.
I bet they expect a legit project to have a proper Twitter account with many followers and many GitHub stars, so they probably don't pay attention to cypherpunks like us who avoid slave tech platforms.
Yeah, you're right. Although we kind of have an official Twitter account now.
Oh yeah, that's true, haha. We should probably explain that to people.
You want to do that?
Nah, you go Mr. Good Accent.
Okay. So after almost 5 years of development, we decided that it was time to grow the Spasm ecosystem, and using a launchpad sounded like a good option to get more attention. Then, after researching different launchpads for a few months, we settled on Virtual's Genesis Launch, which is a platform focused on AI agents. And since Spasm is a perfect solution for AI agents, we thought that the Virtual's platform will benefit from integrating Spasm. However, in order to use Virtual's launchpad, we had to register a Twitter account because that was a requirement. So we were pretty much forced to use Twitter.
Not really. Nobody forced us to use Virtual's.
Yeah, okay. Agree. Anyway, that's how we ended up with a Twitter account. We haven't really used it, though.
But there were a lot of scammers contacting us. Want to talk about that?
Yeah, why not? I guess it's an interesting topic and it does relate to Ethereum, so let's talk about it. Ask me some questions to start the conversation.
Sure. So when did scammers start contacting you and what's the common pitch?
Okay. First of all, I think it's important to clarify that not all of them are scammers in the traditional meaning of that word. I would say that the majority of them are simply trying to sell their promotion services. So it's not really a scam.
Well, it is kind of a scam because most of followers or likes that you get from such promoters are fake. They don't come from real people. These are all just bots.
Yeah. Of course. It is useful if you want to get some likes on your tweets to create an illusion of a social proof, but you won't get real followers from these people.
Besides, there are some real scammers up there. They will just take your money and then block you.
True, that happens as well. I believe you had that experience, right? Want to share?
Sure. So I've used DexTools.io about a year or two ago to promote a token.
Do you mind explaining what DexTools is for the listeners?
Okay, sure. So there are major websites that track crypto prices like the Malaysian one called CoinGecko, or that other one, the big one, the old one. What was it? CoinMarketCap. Yeah, it's owned by Binance. However, these websites usually don't list new coins and meme coins with low market cap. So there are many smaller websites that specialize on new tokens, meme coins, and all sorts of degen stuff.
And let's explain that these are not traditional meme coin launch pads, because these websites simply list prices with graphs, Uniswap pairs, provide some extra info about a token contract, and so on. And it's usually all auto-generated information from some third-party services.
Right, right. It's like data aggregators. There are a bunch of them, like Dex Tools, Dex Screener, BirdEye, and others. So on these websites, you can pay some money to get an official promotion for your token. And that's what I did about a year or two ago.
Okay, did it work? Like, did you get many new followers?
That's a funny one. I did, and I did not.
Okay, continue.
Oh, I didn't get many new followers, but I received a lot of messages from these crypto Twitter promoters. I think there is some filter on Twitter that doesn't allow you to send direct messages to other users if you don't meet certain criteria. I don't really know how that filter works, but I guess that your account needs to be old enough, and you need to have a high amount of followers.
I'm sure it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, it probably is, but whatever. And so some of those promoters send you a direct message because they meet the criteria, while others simply reply to your tweet asking you to message them for some collaboration. And I got a lot of them. Like, a lot.
Like how many?
I don't know. But probably about 100 people contacted me in a week or so.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. And how much did you pay for that?
I think the price was around $300.
Nice. That sounds like a good deal, doesn't it?
Well, that was a fair price to see that side of the crypto industry, but it didn't really help the project.
Were there some legit collaboration requests?
I don't think so. No.
Wait, so all of those 100 people were crypto promoters?
Pretty much, yeah. It was funny.
And what were the prices for such promotions or collaborations, or whatever they call it?
Well, it varies a lot. Some offers were damn cheap, like $20 for a retweet or so. Others were more expensive, but usually in the range of $50 or $100. And it's interesting that all of those promoter accounts have at least tens of thousands of followers. Sometimes even hundreds of thousands of followers. And if you scroll their account feeds, there are tons of likes and retweets. Basically, if you know nothing about crypto, you would think these are legit accounts.
Yeah, that's scary.
Man, Twitter is fucked. It's garbage.
So have you tried any of those promotions?
Hell yeah. Of course I did, haha. I guess I was a bit naive, but also curious whether it will give any results. So I talked with many of those promoters. Most of them are completely dumb, like really dumb. Many don't even speak proper English, or they use chatbots to write replies.
Sounds like a fun experience.
Oh, it was hilarious. I laughed my ass off. Eventually, I found a few somewhat smart people who agreed to install Session so we can get at least some basic privacy.
And how did that go?
So one girl just scammed me, ha ha ha.
Did she catfish you?
Oh, fuck off. Nah, she was a typical promoter. We discussed the price for a few tweets or retweets. I don't remember the details. I told her about the project. Apparently, she liked it, and so I sent her some tokens. I don't really like hiring people for jobs, because that often gives me this weird feeling of fake relations and that I kind of own them. I'm not a communist or something, and I don't have any issues with buying or selling stuff, but I don't know. I very much prefer working in a team of free men who have shares of the project, for example in the form of tokens, so they are still free, but they choose to work together. Do you know what I mean?
Sort of. Yeah. And so what happened with that girl?
Yeah. So I eventually sent her some tokens and told her that she was a free woman, and so on. Well, I was trying to get more people into the project, so I thought that giving people free tokens was a good strategy.
Okay, makes sense. And what happened next?
So we talked for a bit longer about crypto, about politics, about anarchy, governments, libertarian ideas, and so on. She then said that she had to sleep, but she was planning to tweet about my project the next morning. Apparently, she had a lot of followers from Asia, and they were already asleep. Well, according to her.
Okay. I think I know where it's all going to. Did she ghost you the next day?
Yes, she absolutely fucking did.
What a lovely story.
Shut up.
But wait, then she didn't really scam you, did she? You just gave her some free tokens and call her a free woman, and she decided to dump you.
Yeah. That's pretty much the story. What can I say? I have a big heart.
You surely do.
Anyway, let's move on.
But wait, I want to hear more of this. It's funny. So did you try other promoters?
Well, that's the thing. After that bitch scammed me.
She didn't scam you. She just ditched you. As a free woman.
Yeah, whatever. After that, I thought that all of those promoters were simply scammers and all their offers were fake.
Oh, you were traumatized. How cute.
Yeah, you can say so. But I was also curious. So I continued talking with another promoter who also installed Session. He was of a different kind, though.
In what way?
Well, he didn't offer any promotion. Instead, he said he would make a short video clip for me. An animation of some sort. About 10 seconds or so. And the price was damn cheap, something around $40 or $50. And that was before AI-generated videos took off, so it was a really good deal. Honestly, I was pretty sure that he was just trying to scam me like that bitch did.
But you obviously sent him some tokens because you have a big heart, right?
Yes, I did. Of course I did. You know, I care about people, and I trust them.
No, you don't. You hate people. That's why you are so against democracy.
Yeah, that's also true. You got me. But don't pretend that I'm the only one against democracy here. Who wants to live under a fucking tyranny? Whether it's a tyranny of the minority or a tyranny of the majority, it's the same shit. It all leads to a police state and no freedoms. Just look at the West.
No. We are not doing it right now.
Well, you brought it up, not me.
Yeah, fair. Let's stick to the tech.
Okay, fuck it. So what I was trying to say is that I generally trust people, especially those who I work with, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it's because you're a good man and you're mostly surrounded by good people, and that makes you think that the majority of people in the crypto industry have good intentions as well. Which is obviously not the case. It's a dark forest, full of predators.
You're probably right. It's like our deep fears in all these movies about aliens invading our planet and destroying humanity reveals more about how we the people treat other species rather than about any hypothetical extraterrestrial visitors.
That's a bit of a stretch. But yeah, I got the analogy. Anyway, so what happened with that guy? Did you tell him that he was a free man? And did he also ditch you the next morning?
So I sent him tokens, and then, a few days later, he said that he needed more money to finish the work.
Here we go again. I think I've heard it somewhere.
Yeah. By that time, I was pretty sure that he was scamming me. But it was interesting, so I continued playing the game. And then I got really surprised that eventually he sent me a video.
No way. Oh wait, so was it that video you shared in the chat group? I remember seeing some funny short animation.
Yep, exactly. So that was the guy. He probably lives in some poor country where everything is cheap, which explains such a low price.
It was a very simple animation, as far as I remember.
Yeah, it was, but it definitely took him at least a few hours to finish the job. And I liked it. It was a funny video for that time. I mean, right now the guy is clearly automated. There is no way he can compete with modern generative models, so he is probably out of job. I also noticed that he sold his tokens a couple of months ago.
Poor guy.
Well, he got a few hundreds. That can be a monthly salary in his country.
Right. Anyway, that was another heartbreaking story. How many of them do you have?
Well, another promoter didn't scam me, and he actually did a pretty good job. He charged about $20 to $30 for one retweet, and he always delivered many likes to my tweets. I tried a few times, and it always worked. However, I quickly noticed that all the traffic coming from him was bots, so I haven't used his services much. I bet it's the same across all other promoters, at least within the same price range.
Interesting. So what's your overall opinion about crypto Twitter?
Well, Twitter is garbage. I already said that. And I agree with you that it's a dark forest, full of scammers, so you have to watch your back. and I'm sure that there are some legit marketing services, but I only tried low-tier promoters, and I can definitely say that they don't worth it. But what about virtuals? I think we talking about virtuals Genesis launch before we fell into a Twitter rabbit hole.
Yeah, we can come back to virtuals. I would say that it was overall great experience. Don't you think so?
I think it was interesting. I agree. Go ahead, tell us more about it, and don't forget about scammers and all the slave tech.
Yeah, so about the slave tech, I guess let me complain a bit. So, the first and the most obvious annoying thing was that we had to use Twitter to submit our application. But I already mentioned that. Another thing was a login process. It was pretty bad. You remember that sign-in with the wallet thing?
Yeah, of course. I think it's very emblematic of the Ethereum community. I saw this form on many websites. You should definitely explain it and also why it's bad.
Okay, true. Let's focus on that then. It is already mentioned in one of our videos, though.
Oh yeah, the one with Morpheus. I like it. I think it's listed on the Spasm website, right?
Yep, that one. If somebody needs visual, then the video is at the Learn section, and maybe even somewhere in Docs. I don't remember.
Cool, but you can still explain it here without any slides, right?
Yeah, I will. So if you ever used any Web3 websites, then you saw a Connect button. It is sometimes called a login button, but it's pretty much an industry standard to label that as Connect. If you click that button, you will see multiple Connect options that typically include some browser wallets, like MetaMask or Rabi, and various mobile wallets. You can usually connect mobile wallets with so-called Wallet Connect.
Yeah, Wallet Connect. I never used that shit. Isn't it centralized?
Well, they were centralized at the start. But then they moved to a more decentralized architecture with its own network and even a token. So centralization is not my biggest concern. I'm more worried about privacy when it comes to Wallet Connect. Anyway, is another rabbit hole, but let's skip it for now.
Okay, whatever. Go ahead.
So there are two main issues with this process at virtuals and at many similar Web3 websites. Firstly, they use a third-party service called Privy to handle the login process.
So much for the Web3 revolution.
Yeah, I know. And so that company manages logins at many major Ethereum websites. If you check their landing page, they list OpenSea, Farcaster, and Solana websites like Jupiter or Pump.Fun. But it gets even worse because Privy got acquired by Stripe, which is a huge and obviously fully compliant US-based corporation that specializes on handling fiat payments in a traditional, centralized way. Basically, Stripe is a typical legacy financial surveillance company.
Great.
And so then you need to sign a login message with your Ethereum or Solana private key, and then you're officially logged in. But here is the catch. This is exactly the same old slave tech-style architecture, based on accounts. But instead of entering your username and passwords, you're signing a login message with a private key, except that it's even worse because of all the middlemen.
Yeah, fucking parasites are everywhere. But you should walk us through the history of this login method like you did before. It's an interesting story.
Okay, so then let's take a few steps back and explain some history. So this process is called sign-in with Ethereum. It's an industry standard, and it has its own EIP.
Explain what the fuck is EIP?
I think most Ethereum people know what EIP is.
Yeah, but look, we might have many different people listen to this shit talking.
Many people? Okay, how many people do you think will listen to this episode?
I mean, we don't have any analytics, so how the fuck would I know?
But what's your best estimation?
I don't know, maybe like two.
Two people? Nice. I think that's a pretty accurate number.
Well, maybe a bit more, or less, I don't know.
I think five would be a great success.
Five? I would open fucking champagne if we get five listeners.
Will your mom listen to this episode?
Well, I don't think so, but who knows?
Okay, so let me explain EIP for your mom then. So EIP stands for Ethereum Improvement Proposal. And it's pretty much a standard naming convention across many other protocols. For example, in the Bitcoin ecosystems, it's called BIP, which stands for Bitcoin Improvement Proposal, or NIP, in the Noster ecosystem, which stands for Noster Improvement Proposal. I remember submitting one a few years ago.
Wait, did you submit NIP? How did it go?
Yeah, I did. A couple of years ago. So there were a few Noster developers that liked my proposal, but it didn't get merged. I think that Noster founder Fiat Jeff didn't like my proposal. Or maybe he just didn't like me because I'm into decentralized finance, Ethereum meme coins, and all these things. You know, he is a Bitcoin maxi, a pretty hardcore maxi actually. And I'm a full degen. Anyway, after that, I didn't submit any proposals. And so even though all Noster events generated on Spasm instances have custom tags, I didn't expand them through NIP. Because I simply don't have time for that. I'm pretty sure that he won't merge my proposals anyways. But that's what I like about Noster. You can just add custom tag fields to an event and do whatever you want with them. You don't need to achieve any consensus as long as events are backwards compatible. It's that simple.
Okay, whatever.
And that's why I integrated Noster into Spasm. I think that overall, Noster is pretty good despite being developed by Bitcoin maxis. It's still a closed ecosystem, though. But let's hold that conversation for a dedicated episode about decentralized social media.
Okay, sure. So you were talking about sign-in with Ethereum.
Yeah. So I was saying that the so-called Web3 authentication method, also known as sign-in with Ethereum, is an industry standard, and it has its own EIP. Actually, it's a pretty long and well-written and detailed EIP. And it was not a bad thing at the start. Don't get me wrong, it was a pretty innovative thing at the time.
Well, that can be said about a lot of tech. Even fucking emails. It was very innovative for its time.
Exactly. I remember how Signal and Telegram brought end-to-end encryption to the masses, or how Matrix introduced federalization to a messaging app. That was all cool and innovative at that time.
Yeah, or disappearing messages. That was a cool shit.
Yes, disappearing messages. That was a real innovation. Was it Telegram or Signal? Who introduced them first? Or was it Wickr?
Yeah, I think it was Wickr. I'm not sure though. I remember that Mr. Robot had disappearing messages in the first or second season, and he definitely used Wickr, so it was probably Wickr.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Even Wickr was cool back in the days, before it was bought by Amazon.
Well, I wouldn't say it was that cool. It was always a closed-source proprietary shit.
True. And it had a centralized architecture.
It's kind of interesting that Mr. Robot featured a closed-source app. Have you ever thought about that?
Do you think it was a product placement?
I have no idea. Fuck Wickr. It's all Hollywood propaganda anyways.
Yeah, it is. By the way, now that I think about it, it might have actually been Telegram that introduced disappearing messages first. Because its founder said in the latest interview with Lex Fridman that they implemented self-destructing messages as early as 2013 or 2014, and I think Mr. Robot came after that.
Whatever, Telegram or Wickr, it's the same slave tech.
Have you listened to that interview?
The one with Telegram founder? Yeah, I did. What do you think about it?
I think it was an interesting one. And it's cool that Lex spent a few weeks hanging out with the Telegram team in Dubai, but it was obviously a very softball interview. Well, like always, I have never heard Lex doing any hard interviews.
Yeah, Lex is a typical slave, with like huge ego. And that other guy, the founder, Pavel, he is just a big liar. He knows exactly what Telegram is. A centralized piece of slave tech without privacy.
Yeah. It was a bit annoying that they sit down for a few hours and pretend that Telegram is some freedom tech. And both of them are developers. They remind me of politicians who always think that everybody are too stupid to understand their manipulation.
Well, they kinda write about that. The majority is dumb.
Yeah, maybe, but you know what I mean. It was such a theater. And by the way, don't get me wrong, I definitely have more respect to Pavel than to Zuckerberg.
Of course, Mark is a compliant pussy. He always worked with the government, no matter who was in office, whether it was Biden or now Trump. So yeah, Pavel definitely has much bigger balls, but he is still a liar, the same as Mark.
Yeah, It's interesting how these two guys with such different personalities develop the exact same slave tech, and they only compete with features, but not with architectures.
Well, I bet they think they're doing something good. That's human nature. To think that you are a saint and everybody else are wrong. We're guilty of that too.
Yeah, that's true.
And what do you think about his rant on using open source libraries?
Well, there were definitely some valid statements. But overall, it was another manipulation.
Explain.
So obviously there are backdoors and zero days in open source software. Just think how many million lines of code are in the Linux kernel. So I agree with him on that. However, any homegrown library can have backdoors and zero days as well. But there are less developers to review such a library. And that's exactly why we should never rely solely on encryption. For example, if encryption used by Session or SimpleX is cracked, we have another line of defense, because there are no phone numbers or emails associated with an account.
SimpleX claims not to use any ID?
Yeah, they claim so, but you know that it's just marketing. Very deceptive marketing, actually. They use chat ID, called something like message queue identifiers, to receive messages. And these ID can be correlated into accounts through metadata analysis. That's why I always recommend to research architectures of Session and SimpleX, so people can understand pros and cons of these two different solutions.
Right, metadata. How come Lex and Pavel completely ignored such an important issue? There is no way Lex doesn't know about metadata. He just intentionally avoids hard questions because he knows that Telegram doesn't have any proper metadata protection. That was not an interview. That was a piece of propaganda.
Yeah, you're probably right. Anyway, what I was trying to say is that sign-in with Ethereum was pretty innovative at the time. Or maybe not that innovative.
So was it or was it not innovative?
Well, let me give you some context and then you can decide by yourself. So a much better approach is obviously a direct signing of all events, whether it's transactions or some configuration events, or simple post or comment messages. Right?
Yeah, go ahead.
And so secure Scuttlebutt, which is a predecessor of Nostr, it has been around since 2014 or so. Then Nostr itself was introduced half a decade later in 2020. Oh yeah, and also Steam. I think it went live a few years after Secure Scuttlebutt, sometime around 2016. And it also used direct signing of all events.
And Bitcoin, that was the start.
Yeah, you're right. Technically, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, they all use direct signing. So I guess we have to add them to the list.
And Spasm, don't be shy.
Well, yeah, of course. Although Spasm came a bit later, in 2021, but you're right. Oh, and Snapshot. That was a big one. Actually, Spasm was largely inspired by Snapshot and its approach.
Explain Snapshot.
Okay. So pretty much all Ethereum people know Snapshot. It's a very popular platform used for decentralized governance, and it has been live for many years. Snapshot is a centralized website, so it's not perfect. Although it's an open source project, so you can run your own instance. Anyway, the most interesting part for us is how they allow different projects to conduct governance polls. Let's say you have a DAO, and you want token holders to vote for some proposal. You have two options. The first option is the most decentralized option, and it's called on-chain governance. This option requires users to vote on-chain, and, ideally, the proposal should be automatically implemented on-chain if passed.
Almost nobody uses it.
Yeah, it's definitely not very popular, but some projects use it. I remember doing some on-chain voting.
Then it was expensive as fuck.
Yeah, that was one of the issues with on-chain governance a few years back, when Ethereum transaction fees were extremely high. It could cost you $50 or $100 to cast your vote during severe network congestions. Obviously, many people didn't like that, so they used the second option, which is off-chain governance. This option is more centralized, because you basically rely on developers to implement all the changes and manually upgrade a smart contract if a proposal passes.
But it's damn cheap, and that's what people like.
Yeah, correct. It's practically free because you don't have to pay any fee in order to cast your vote. You just open Snapshot, connect your wallet, and then directly sign a message. Basically, your vote,
And there is no third-party login bullshit?
Yes, that's correct. No login, no privy, no Stripe. You just connect your wallet and directly sign your vote, which is a simple message that you can understand. Well, if you know how to read a JSON object.
And no middlemen or other parasites?
Yep. No middlemen. Well, technically Snapshot itself is a middleman. But as I mentioned, you can run your own Snapshot instance on your own website. And that's what many serious projects did. In that setup, you don't have any middlemen.
So it means that the Ethereum community has been directly signing offline messages for a long time. I mean, not just transactions or some login shit, right?
Yes, exactly. And that's what always bothered me. Look, so Secure Scuttlebutt was a pretty niche product because not many people knew about, right? Then Steam and later its fork Hive had their own blockchains, so they didn't use Ethereum. And of course, Nostr is a Bitcoin maxi project with its own private key. And finally, Spasm went live in 2021. But you can argue that most people haven't heard about it yet. But here is the thing. Snapshot has been around for so many years, and it always used direct signing instead of all this login BS.
Okay, so you're basically frustrated that Ethereum guys have been exposed to direct signing for many years, but they chose outdated slave tech architecture instead. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And yes, it is very frustrating.
Yeah? It's kind of sad that people often choose slave tech, even when presented with a much better alternative.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, fuck it. So were you inspired by Snapshot?
I actually was, yes. I remember doing some off-chain voting around 2020, during so-called DeFi summer. And I thought that anything can be signed in a similar way. Even messages like posts or comments. And that's how I came up with an idea of Spasm. So yeah, Snapshot was definitely cool, and it was a major inspiration for me.
And so, why do you think sign-in with Ethereum became an industry standard, while direct signing didn't get much adoption yet?
That's a good question. To be honest, I don't really have an answer. I'm sure that there are many factors involved. But I can share some thoughts if you want.
Yes, please, go ahead. I'm sure you have some good insights.
So if you look at Secure Scuttlebutt, Nostr, Snapshot, Steam, or Spasm, these are all independent projects without much initial funding. Well, with the exception of Steam, which had enough funds from the start, but it was still pretty independent. And as we know, it's usually very hard for independent projects to get enough exposure and adoption.
Right.
For example, just think about it. How often do you hear about Arbitrum or Farcaster? Is it because they have amazing tech or is it because they have a lot of money to spend for marketing?
Yeah. Arbitrum. That's another VC-backed shit promoted by the Bankless podcast and other paid shows.
Exactly. VC-backed. The Ethereum ecosystem is captured by VC money. And now let's think for a little bit. Let's say you pitched a project to investors and got some initial funding. First of all, you will have to disclose your identity. Then you will have to use traditional banking, and you will get money from fully compliant and often US-based companies, which obviously comes with strings attached. These are all major red flags when it comes to innovation, especially in a Web3 space.
Yeah, you cannot really innovate if you take VC money.
Yep, you cannot. Although to be fair, there are a few exceptions like Uniswap, but that's very rare.
Oh, Uniswap is cool. It's sad that their token is stagnating for so many years.
Well, they have bad tokenomics. But yeah, Uniswap is great. It's hardcore. I mean the protocol, not the front end. But anyway, back to my rant. And so imagine you took all those VC money and fully compromised your privacy. And now you cannot really innovate. And so what do you do then? You hire some senior developers who've been working for Web2 companies for all their lives, and you tell them to innovate and think in a Web3 way. And so, do you really think they will come up with some completely new Web3 architecture?
Hell no. These cocksuckers are slaves with typical slave mindset.
Exactly. Well, not exactly. But yeah, you got the gist. Besides, even if developers want to create new architectures, they often can't, because they have to provide return on investment, which means that they have to create closed ecosystems so they can capture users and then monetize them. And that's usually a part of the initial pitch. Otherwise, you won't get any funding to begin with. And so you end up creating the same old slave tech dressed up in Web3 clothing.
Yeah, slave tech dressed up as Web3, so true.
And of course, you then have to use Telegram, Twitter, Discord, and other slave tech to promote your project and please your VC masters.
Yeah, I think it was Amir from DarkFi. He said something like, if you're using Twitter and Discord, then you're not afraid. And if you're not afraid, then you are not developing anything important.
Yes, very well said.
But how about all these hackathons and hackathon winners?
What about them?
Like, they don't come from Web2. And there are many young guys who actually innovate?
Well, a lot of hackathon participants actually come from Web2. But generally, you're right, there is more innovation happening there, at least at the first stage. But also, a lot of these hackathons are pretty fake.
Fake?
Well, maybe fake is not the right word. But what I mean is that many hackathons are often organized in a way that doesn't lead to a situation in which its winners are motivated enough to continue working on a project after the hackathon is over.
Why is that? Give some examples.
Okay, so let's look at a typical hackathon. Often there will be multiple sponsors, like well-known brands with money. Let's say Arbitrum and Farcaster.
Fuck Arbitrum and Farcaster.
Yeah. But they have a lot of money to spend. So let's say they sponsor a hackathon, and they would usually require a project to meet certain criteria in order to be eligible for a prize. For example, a project must be deployed on Arbitrum or be integrated with Farcaster.
Yeah, that's a common.
And so let's say each sponsor will allocate money for one or two categories. Usually one, but since many hackathon organizers allow projects to enter multiple categories, it leads to a situation in which teams often try to tick all the boxes to qualify for as many prizes as they can. And so they integrate everything, even stuff that their projects don't need.
Okay, I see.
For example, let's say you are a fresh graduate and you need money, and you enroll into a hackathon. You have a great idea that can change the Web3 space, but it doesn't qualify for any category, or maybe it only qualifies for some general goods category with a small prize. And so you have a choice to either compete for one small prize, or integrate a lot of unnecessary stuff and try to win multiple prizes. So what you gonna do? And don't forget that you actually need money.
Right. I'll probably integrate all the shit I can.
Exactly. And so you deploy to Arbitrum and integrate Farcaster, and then you add notifications from the push network, and maybe send some messages to the Waku network, and then integrate some zero-knowledge stuff, like some Polygon ID or whatever.
Right.
And some of these integrated solutions might be even pretty good, but here's the thing. Your original project didn't need any of these. None. And so will you continue working on your hackathon project after the event is over?
Nah, probably not.
Exactly. Your code base is now a total mess, and there is no need to continue working on a project because it's fake. Instead, you want to work on your original idea, but you don't have money for that. Well, maybe you won some hackathon prizes, but that's not enough to implement your original idea. And so what you do?
Oh man, I don't know. Wash some dishes?
Okay, that's one option. But most likely you just apply for some regular developer job and start working for some closed ecosystem, probably backed by VC money. Or you enroll into another hackathon and try the same trick again. I know people doing exactly that. For years, they just jump from one hackathon to another with different projects and collect prizes. And finally, you have another option. You can try to raise VC money to continue working on your original project, but then you'll have to adjust your idea so investors can get returns, which often means that you will have to turn your project into a closed ecosystem, another slave tech project dressed in Web3 clothing.
Fuck, man. That's dark.
Well, it is what it is.
Nah, that's dark. So are you saying that hackathons should not allow projects to enter many categories?
Not exactly. I mean, stricter rules might be useful, and some hackathon organizers actually do that. But this doesn't fix the underlying problem. For example, let's say you can only apply for one category, and so you can either compete in some general goods category if it exists, or you can integrate some unnecessary library from one of the sponsors and enter that category. Obviously, using one unnecessary library is much better than using five of them. But fundamentally, it's still the same story, because your project doesn't need this library to begin with. And even if you win the main prize, and that sponsor decides to fund your project further, you will have to integrate even more stuff that you don't need. And most sponsors are closed ecosystems, often backed by VC money, so you are just stuck in the same loop.
Man, that's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, I know. And don't forget about corruption.
What corruption?
There is a lot of corruption. Just think about it. Many hackathons are organized by locals, and they know many developers who are enrolled into these hackathons. And so organizers rarely put their own money into the prize pot, because they usually get money from sponsors. But these sponsors rarely send their own representatives to these events.
Right.
It's very common for organizers to judge the hackathon and decide the winners, and that's a major conflict of interest, for too often they will prioritize their friends. And I'm not saying that organizers always choose their friends as winners, but personal connections definitely affect final decisions.
That's fucked up. So what's your solution then? How would you fix hackathons?
To be honest, I don't think that we can fix hackathons by applying a few small patches here and there. We need to rethink the whole concept of hackathons in the Web3 space if we want to foster open ecosystems and freedom tech in general.
Okay, but do you have any suggestions? Or like a wish list?
A wish list. Yeah, that sounds right. So we should definitely prioritize general goods projects instead of forcing projects to integrate some VC-backed slave tech.
General goods. Do you mean public goods?
Yes, sorry. Of course, I meant public goods. We need to prioritize public goods projects.
Yeah, sounds reasonable. But how would you do that? You cannot just force sponsors to give up their money.
Well, you said a wish list, right? So I'm just saying what would be good to have. But yeah, if you want to hear the exact strategy to achieve this result, then here is one option. As an organizer, you can add a condition for each sponsor that at least 20% or even 40% of funds must go to a general admission category. For example, let's say that a sponsor wants to spend $10,000 for prizes. So you can demand $2,000 or even $4,000 to be spent on public goods projects, and then you can require projects in that category to be open ecosystems with high interoperability. That way you're going to support freedom tech.
Yeah, it makes sense. But it sounds a bit like communism, no? Or rather socialism, with all these high taxes and redistribution.
Not really. Nobody is forced to sponsor hackathons. These are all privately organized events, and you can choose to participate or not.
But then, do you really think that hackathons with such strict rules can survive in a free market environment? I mean, hackathons need prizes, and as a typical VC-backed business, why would I sponsor a hackathon in which 40% of my funds will be allocated for development of some open ecosystems? These might be my direct competitors.
Well, it's definitely not a perfect solution. As I said, it's hard to fix hackathons. I'm just giving you my wish list. And it might work. There are a lot of real-world companies that sell expensive products that are, for example, ethically sourced. And there is a lot of demand for such products. And people are willing to pay premium because they want to feel good about how they spend their money. Right?
Right.
Many people don't want to sponsor some child labor, or forced labor, or even animal cruelty. Well, assuming that they have some extra money to spend for alternative products, and they are not just living from paycheck to paycheck. And so we can apply the same concept to hackathons. Create hackathons that prioritize public goods projects, open ecosystems, freedom tech, and so on. Like ethical hackathon.
Yeah, it sounds nice. But I'm not sure that this will work. And it does smell a bit like ESG.
Well, of course there will be people who will try to corrupt this concept. But you just have to be vigilant and call them out. Anyway, that's just one suggestion. And speaking of corruption, I think if you sponsor a hackathon, then it's important to send some team members to such an event, so they can both help participants and also pick the winners without bias. Alternatively, you can have multiple winners, so some of them will be picked on site, while others will be determined later by the core team. Although I feel like a lot of companies are already doing that, so that's a common knowledge.
Okay, what else?
So I would also change the prize structure. For example, instead of giving $10,000 to one winner, I would split the prize between two or three projects and give them another month to complete the next milestone and compete for more funding. Basically, the main prize should be not just cash, but an opportunity to get more and more funding for a project.
And all of that should be public goods projects, right? And nobody should force developers to use some slave tech shit, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so who gonna fund all of that? I don't think you can raise enough funds by just forcing regular VC companies to allocate a certain amount of hackathon prizes to public goods.
Yeah, I know. Funding public goods is a hard challenge to solve in a free market.
Ah, you fucking communist. I know where you're going to.
I'm not a communist.
Yeah, I know. I'm just joking.
So what I was trying to say is that funding public goods is hard, and we definitely need more very rich philanthropists to be much more proactive, and we need some serious cypherpunk funds, or lunar punk funds, that will support freedom tech.
Like that LunarDAO.
Yeah, kind of. I like their concept, but I don't think they were able to raise much funds.
Or that Pineapple Fund.
Yes, Pineapple Fund is actually a good example. It was a really cool project, but it was a very short-lived one-time initiative. Do you want to explain it to the listeners?
Sure. So there was a cypherpunk who got secretly rich on Bitcoin, and he didn't know what to do with all his money. And so he decided to donate a big chunk of his wealth during a market peak. That was around 2017. I think Bitcoin was at its all-time high, around 20 grand or so. And so he donated like 80 million to many charities. Probably more than 50 projects received donations from him. And donations varied from 500 grand to a few millions. That was cool. Like, really cool.
Yep, it was. Many open source projects got funding for a few years in advance. Although, he only donated to major well-known registered and compliant nonprofit organizations. So a lot of true cypherpunk projects were left aside.
Yeah, that's true. I think he also donated to some mushrooms therapies.
Yeah, there was something regards to psychedelic research, but I don't remember the details.
He became quite a star that time.
Yes, he did. And we still don't know his identity. That's the cool thing. He didn't try to clean up his reputation with donations or something like that. Instead, it was real genuine philanthropy.
Yeah, but how about grants? What do you think about them? They fund public good projects, right?
Yes, grants. That's a good segue to another interesting topic.
That's called the teamwork.
So I checked different grant options in the Ethereum ecosystem this year, and it's pretty bad. All grants that I saw require KYC, so you have to disclose your identity.
KYC. Yeah, that's bad. Compliant pussies, and it's also very disrespectful. If you require a Web3 developer to disclose his identity, then you clearly don't give a shit about him and about his safety. Given the hostile environment we live in, just look at Tornado Cash, folks. They are completely fucked. Poor guys going through hell now, and then Ethereum companies pretend that they care and donate money to a legal defense fund. And then the same companies require KYC to get some fucking grants. That's such a hypocrisy.
Yeah, that's true. And don't forget Samurai developers. They're in a very bad situation as well.
Yeah, and Roger Ver? And that Bitcoin mixer guy, Roman something.
The Sterlingov. Roman Sterlingov.
Yeah, that one. And also that poor guy who did some Ethereum talk at the North Korean conference.
Yes. I think he pleaded guilty like many people do.
Yeah, he did. I don't blame him, though. Because the whole system is fucked. Like, completely fucked. And also very corrupt.
True. There are a few very interesting interviews with Roman Sterlingov attorneys, Tor and Michael. As you know, he chose to fight. And so his attorneys decided to attend different Bitcoin and Monero events to talk about his case and raise money for his legal defense. They also went to a few podcasts like Monero Talk and What Bitcoin Did and they talked about all the nonsense in Roman's case, and then later about all the BS during his trial, and all the corruption, especially surrounding Chainalysis. It definitely worth listening to.
Yeah, fucking Chainalysis. I think there is a whole book about them.
Yes, there is. I don't remember the name, though. And there's also a news outlet called The Rage, and they do a pretty good coverage of all these major cases. But anyway, let's go back to Ethereum. What were we talking about before that?
I think you were raging about grants.
Ah, yes. So all grants that I saw require KYC. And I actually even applied for a grant from the Ethereum Foundation at the start of the year. I obviously was not planning to do any KYC myself, but I was curious about the whole process and whether we can negotiate some sort of deal.
You fucking hypocrite.
Haha, thanks.
Why did you do that?
Well, I was trying to raise some funds to grow the Spasm ecosystem, so I was just checking different options. And it was a good opportunity to showcase Spasm to the Ethereum Foundation. I mean, the Ethereum private key was literally the first key to be integrated into Spasm in 2021, so it totally made sense to approach the Ethereum Foundation, right?
Okay, maybe. Still a hypocrite, though, but whatever. And so how did it go?
Ah, the same. They just ignored me. Well, technically, I got a generic email reply from one guy saying that they were sorry, and so on. Some standard AI-generated BS. I'm not even sure that he reviewed my application. And I sent a few follow-ups trying to get some other contacts from him. But he never replied back.
What a heartbreaking story. How much money did you request?
Well, that one is a bit funny. So the maximum limit was 250,000. But I asked for 1 million.
You're fucking punk.
Yes, I am. Full degen hunk.
No wonder they ignored you.
Well, 1 million was like an upper limit. I clearly stated in the application that any sum would be useful, and I can even work with them for free. For example, I can help them pimp their forums with Spasm for free, and we can also add features that they request. Besides, 1 million is not that much if you think about it. Many startups raise much more than that, and sometimes even during a seed round, and Spasm is literally the future of social media. So 1 million is not much.
Yeah, but the Ethereum Foundation is not VCs. They donate money. They don't invest.
Well, I'm sure that they have enough money, and they definitely need a good Web3 social media solution, because all other existing solutions are trash. And look at Noster. One of the reasons why it got so big is because Jack Dorsey supported the project early on. He donated a few hundred thousand directly to Noster founder, without any KYC. And he also started actively using and promoting the network.
Jack Dorsey? You mean Twitter founder?
Yes, Twitter co-founder. And he also allocated millions of dollars to the development of Noster through an organization called OpenSats.
OpenSats? Isn't it some Bitcoin maxi shit? And I think they are registered compliant pussies who also don't give a fuck about developers because they require KYC, right?
Yes, they do require KYC, and that's obviously bad, but that's not the point. The point is that Jack donated millions to the Noster ecosystem, and that helped grow the network. And he didn't invest into Noster. No. He donated to Noster. And I'm sure that the Ethereum Foundation has enough money, so 1 million was a reasonable amount. Besides, as I mentioned, it would have created a positive impact of the price of Ether. And it was an upper limit. Like a suggestion, or a wish list.
Yeah, I get it. But they don't have to support you or donate any money to any project.
Yes, of course. They don't have to. But then they're going to lose competition with other similar ecosystems like Solana or Binance Chain.
So would you say that Ethereum is also a closed ecosystem? And that it competes with other networks exactly like all these VC-backed layer 2 scaling solutions do?
That's a good question. I guess you're right because Ethereum does require the usage of one particular private key, and it relies on one blockchain to settle all the transactions. So it's not agnostic by design, and it lacks native interoperability with other networks.
Right.
Although, there are many bridges, but you can often bridge closed ecosystems as well.
So then, how is Ethereum better than other closed ecosystems that try to capture users and extract revenue?
Again. That's a good question. I don't know, I need to think about it. I guess it's a bit different when it comes to finance because you have to solve a double spend problem and achieve consensus on the state of the network, unlike in off-chain social media solutions like Spasm or Nostr, where consensus is not needed. But I see your point. Ethereum is definitely not perfect, and we can certainly classify it as a closed ecosystem. But I like it. It's currently the most censorship-resistant solution for decentralized finance. But I obviously use other cryptos as well, like Monero, Solana, and even Bitcoin. And there are plans to integrate many different private keys into Spasm.
You sound a bit like an Ethereum fanboy. An angry one.
Why angry one?
I don't know. I think that you're angry at the foundation for ignoring your application.
Really? Well, we can move to another topic if you think that I'm biased on this one.
Nah, it's fine. I'm just saying.
Okay, thanks. Actually, you might be right. I might have a bit of resentment towards the Ethereum Foundation. But you know, I'm a human being.
What? I thought you were a robot.
Haha. You are a robot.
Nah, I'm an AI agent. That's another level. Robots are fucking dumb. So what's the conclusion about grants?
I don't think there is any conclusion. As you said, I was just raging and sharing my experience. I think it's interesting.
Okay. And so do you have any data on how many grants the Ethereum Foundation approves every year?
No, I don't. Maybe they publish some transparency reports, but I haven't searched for that. I definitely know that they give some good grants. I once met a guy who received a 100,000 grant from them.
That's cool. Did he KYC himself?
Yes. Unfortunately, he had to do that.
That's bad. So I guess that's the conclusion for this topic then. They should definitely get rid of any KYC requirements.
Yeah, they should. But also they have an officially registered organization. So how would they drop KYC?
How the fuck would I know? I'm not a lawyer. They have shit tons of resources to figure it out. Look at all those multinational corporations. They somehow figured how to not pay taxes, right? So I'm sure that Ethereum folks can figure out how to avoid all this unnecessary paperwork. They can use some DAO for that, like buy some tokens on the open market. That will pump the price of that token. And then have some DAO allocating funds to developers through some voting without any paperwork. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that there are many ways to do that.
Maybe.
Look at Monero, guys. They somehow figured that out, right? You can just submit a proposal and get funding without any KYC.
Well, that's a bit different because that's crowdfunding. The Monero community has a more decentralized approach to funding public goods. The Ethereum community also does crowdfunding, but using more centralized options like Gitcoin.
Ah, fucking Gitcoin. Another centralized compliance shit. It's like the worst things you can only imagine about crowdfunding implemented in one platform. And they also require KYC, don't they?
Yes, they do. Well, actually, it depends on how much money you raise. I think you have to go through KYC if you raise more than $20,000 or something like that. But yeah, most serious public goods projects require more than $20,000, so I guess we can say that it does require KYC. So, it's also pretty bad.
Yeah, I remember a few years back they blocked all open source developers from Iran. Fucking pussies. And then a lot of cocksuckers were defending them like they had no choice because of sanctions. That was such a bullshit.
Can you unpack that?
What do you want me to unpack? They chose to have a company. They chose to be incorporated in the most hostile jurisdiction. They chose to comply with all sorts of bullshit. And they chose centralized architecture.
Yeah, true. Especially the last point. Because I don't think that we should expect everybody to be super brave and ready to sacrifice their lives even for the good cause. But you're definitely right that they could have chosen a decentralized architecture, and that would have fixed most of the issues.
And they also have this quadratic funding shit.
Oh, quadratic funding. That's a very good topic, but also a very controversial one.
Why is it controversial?
Well, what I mean is that a lot of people will not agree with your opinion, or our opinion, on quadratic funding. That's different from other stuff that we've already discussed in this episode. Because a lot of things that we said are pretty straightforward, or better say pretty obvious, like they are not very controversial. It's just most people never heard an alternative opinion. But with quadratic funding is different. Many people stick to the mainstream opinion that it's a good thing, even when presented with an alternative opinion. I've experienced that multiple times. Do you know what I mean?
No, I don't. But whatever.
Well, do you want to explain your position on quadratic funding then?
Why me again? You can rage on this one. I don't mind.
Well, you're a bad cop here.
Haha. What? Why am I a bad cop?
Well, you're the one here calling everybody pussies and other names, not me. And I have to onboard people to spasm, and it's hard to do that after publicly criticizing them, you know?
Ah, you fucking politician. Same like that Telegram guy. Anyway, whatever. So quadratic funding is an amazing tool if you want to destroy your community. Basically, it's a socialist Trojan horse, and also a justification for all sorts of dystopian things like Gitcoin Passport or that WorldCoin shit.
Can you explain, what do you mean by a socialist Trojan horse?
Yeah, easy. So imagine you start a community, like a cypherpunk community, and most people there value decentralization, privacy, censorship resistance, self-custody, and so on. And over the years, your community grew up, became big, and many early adopters became pretty rich. And so they have money to directly fund public goods projects that stick to the same original values. The values that the community was built on, right?
Yeah, and then?
And then imagine you introduce some centralized, compliant crowdfunding platform that promotes quadratic funding, which gives a lot of voting power to newcomers, many of whom don't share the same values. On opposite, many of them join during a market peak because of all the hype, and so they just want to get rich fast. They don't give a shit about your values, like decentralization and such. They would happily sacrifice all these core principles to pump the prices even higher. It's like flooding your community with illegal immigrants and then immediately giving them voting rights. Not that I'm in favor of nation states or something. That's also bullshit. But that would be a real-world example of quadratic funding, and that's why it's a fucking Trojan horse. A socialist Trojan horse?
Yeah, giving voting rights to illegal immigrants, that's a good analogy. And that's why I called it controversial. And also, I wouldn't say that all socialists are in favor of open borders. That's more like an American leftist agenda.
Whatever, you got the point.
Yes, I did. And also, I think we should explain what quadratic funding is, because I realize that many people might not be familiar with this concept.
Yeah, maybe. You go, Mr. Good Cop.
So first of all, we should distinguish quadratic voting from quadratic funding implemented by Gitcoin, because these two are not the same thing. Let's say that a well-known crypto company wants to support some public goods projects. For example, MetaMask.
Fuck MetaMask.
Yes, I was afraid that you're gonna say something like that, so I used another company this time.
Well, you should try better.
Okay. I know, let's say it's Uniswap.
Fine, that's better.
Okay, so Uniswap wants to support some public goods projects, but instead of directly donating to such projects, they decide to distribute funds through Gitcoin with quadratic funding. And so all donations to qualified projects will be matched by Uniswap. But here's the catch. They won't match donations one-to-one, but instead they will allocate more funds to the projects that receive many small donations, even if the majority of such donations are just $1.
Yeah, and that creates even more problems, because now they have to prevent Sybil attacks with all this passport shit.
Right, it does. Can you elaborate on that, though?
Sure. So let's say that $1 donation is not really a donation, but rather a vote. And if you can get many votes by, for example, using multiple accounts, then you can game the whole system. And so Gitcoin has to implement mechanisms to prevent that, or rather to make it difficult. And since it's pretty easy to use bots or hijacked accounts, they came up with a Gitcoin Passport, which is, again, one of the worst things you can only imagine.
Yeah. Can you explain why is that bad?
Okay, so there are many reasons why Gitcoin Passport is a horrible idea. Firstly, it's very much against core cypherpunk values like privacy, and you cannot fix that with some ZK plug. because in a private environment, like a real dark forest environment, you should be able to easily spin up as many identities as you want.
Hmm.
Now, there's definitely some value in reputation-based systems, but they are not as good as trustless systems. For example, Monero is a trustless system, while peer-to-peer markets are reputation-based systems. Although most markets have escrows, but you still have to trust admins to behave honestly. Regardless whether it's a centralized market like Open Monero, or a supposedly more decentralized alternative like Avino, you still have to trust admins, so these are not trustless systems.
Okay. And by admins, you mean people who resolve disputes, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So let me try to summarize then. What you're saying is that Gitcoin incentivizes people to use only one permanent identity and invest resources into gaining more reputation for that identity. While in a privacy-focused ecosystem, people should be able to easily utilize multiple identities for various activities, whether it's financial activities like making some transactions, or social activities like leaving some spicy comments. Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. What else you don't like about a Gitcoin passport? And by the way, they call it a human passport now.
Yeah, so another issue is that this passport relies heavily on slave tech platforms like GitHub or even fucking Binance. Binance, a centralized exchange that literally enforces KYC. And so Gitcoin wants you to completely give up your privacy for what? So you can donate some money? No. Because if you have enough money to donate, then you can do that directly. You don't need any middleman like Gitcoin for that. But if you don't have money, then that's a different story. Because then they want you to give up your privacy in exchange for the right to vote. How is that not redistribution of wealth? How is that not socialism? Just give up your privacy, be a compliant slave, and vote for projects that we whitelisted for you. That's an illusion of freedom. And it gets worse because other unrelated projects use this Gitcoin passport or human passport. Whatever you call it, it's like a fucking government ID. People used to be free. You could just hop on a ship and sail wherever you want. But now we are forced to have these government ID like fucking slaves. Like we don't exist without these papers and all this other bureaucratic bullshit. And the same with the internet. It used to be free. You could do or say whatever you want back in the days. And now it's so heavily controlled and regulated. Well, at least the clear net. And so the same with crypto. There used to be so much more freedom. Even fucking Binance used to list Monero and not require any ID verification. Even Binance. But the prices kept on rising and rising, and more people understood that fiat was shit. And then came VC and the Wall Street and then regular Joes and all other slaves and compliant pussies. And so look at crypto now. Fucking KYC everywhere. Custodial wallets, tons of middlemen and other parasites. And Gitcoin is playing the exact same game with its fucking passport and quadratic funding. A centralized company based in a very hostile jurisdiction that enforces KYC and blocks open source developers if they were born in wrong countries. That's what your Gitcoin is.
Wow. That was quite a rage. I don't really know what to say. I'd only add that one of the selling points of this Gitcoin or human passport is that with some zero knowledge, you can verify that a person is not on a sanction list.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. Fucking slave tech. Let the governments decide who can and who cannot use crypto. The same as this dystopian iris scanning world coin shit. I thought we were building permissionless and censorship-resistant systems. I guess I was wrong. I guess we are just pumping our bags.
Hmm. It seems like Vitalik is a fan of this human passport and proof of humanity in general.
Well, I'm not surprised. He is solar punk as fuck.
Actually, I'm not sure about that. I heard Vitalik is slowly shifting towards lunar punk as he gets older.
I don't know, man. I don't have much faith in him. Anyway, did you try pitching Spasm to him?
No, I didn't. I don't know if he uses any privacy apps, and we don't really have many common friends.
You mean you have zero common friends?
Yes, you can say so.
And did you try pitching to other Ethereum billionaires?
Nope, I didn't. And I don't really know other extremely rich Ethereum people since I don't use Twitter.
How about Jack? That Twitter founder you mentioned before. Have you thought about contacting him?
Yes, I actually did. I mean, I didn't just think about it, but I actually did reach out. Well, sort of.
Why sort of?
Well, I sent him a direct message on Nostr. But I'm not sure if he saw it because he might have a lot of messages from scammers and fans. Then I tried reaching out through some common friends, but it didn't really work. Anyway, he is a Bitcoin maxi, so there is a very low chance that he will even research Spasm.
So would you say that he is a good guy?
That's a good question. To be honest, for many years I thought that he was an adversary.
Why?
Well, he is a co-founder of Twitter, and he was its CEO during all this crazy censorship amid COVID and then Trump drama. And he also launched this centralized custodial cash app, basically another legacy financial surveillance company for slaves.
Yeah? That doesn't sound like he cares much about freedom of speech or self-custody of funds or privacy.
Right. And I guess the biggest issue was that he was actively supporting the Lightning Network. Around the same time when I was fighting against it being used as a primary scaling solution. I definitely remember seeing him as an adversary that time.
Ah, Lightning Network, the biggest scam in the Bitcoin history.
Yeah, I think we all have scars from that scaling war and its aftermath. Do you want to talk about that?
Nah, fuck Lightning. Let's not waste our time on slave tech.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily label Lightning as slave tech. Because technically, you can have a pretty good self-custodial setup with a high level of privacy. I met a few people doing that. But that requires running your own full node and having another server for backups. And you can still lose all your funds. And then there's a problem of metadata, so it's still not very private.
Yeah, good luck managing all that shit. The vast majority of people use custodial Lightning wallets with zero privacy. It's the same as fucking banking. And that's why it's slave tech, like all those brainless Bitcoin maxes zapping each other on Nostr.
Yeah, I know. Nostr zaps are awful. But what I was trying to say is that off-chain scaling solutions based on state channels have legit use cases. For example, such solutions are good for arbitrage between centralized exchanges. And there are other use cases, especially in a B2B sector. But they pushed it as the only scaling solution for retails. And that was the problem. It was pretty obvious from the start that a sophisticated decentralized marketplace for watchtowers was a complete fantasy, because people would rather use centralized custodial solutions. And that's exactly what happened.
I'm surprised that they're still betting on Lightning, even a decade later.
Well, they actually don't. I know a few Bitcoin maxis and I occasionally talk with Bitcoin people. And so I've noticed a big shift in the mainstream narrative about a year ago. I would even say that a lot of maxis started admitting that Lightning was a failure. And they also started exploring other scaling options. So there are some positive changes happening.
I don't know, man. I think that Bitcoin is fucked. Although the network is pretty decentralized, we have to admit that.
Yeah, that's true. It's the most decentralized network that runs on proof of work. And it's amazing that we now have two huge networks that use different consensus mechanisms. So it's nice that Ethereum migrated to proof of stake. Because diversity enhances resilience as it ensures that we don't have a single point of failure.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. But then why is Jack a good guy and not an adversary? If he supported Lightning and he ran all those other centralized apps, I didn't really understand your line of thinking.
Okay, well. So as I said, I thought that he was an adversary for a long time, but then I guess I slowly changed my mind as I learned more about the guy. And I genuinely think that he has good intentions.
Well, as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah, I know. Seen that many times. But you should listen to some of his interviews because he really sounds like a good guy. I think that he is just brainwashed and falls for all this tribal thing.
Well, that Telegram founder also sounds like a good guy, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's true. I can't deny that. Anyway, at least Jack donated millions to Nostr and Nostr is pretty cool. You know that.
Yeah. You're right. I guess we have to give him credits for this one.
Yes, we have to. Basically, I don't think that an influential person is an adversary just because he has different values. For example, do you see guys from the Bankless podcast as adversaries or just simple paid shills who extract value from the audience by promoting slave tech platforms?
Definitely adversaries, 100%.
Why adversaries? Why not just paid shills?
Because it's a fucking war. It's not peacetime, man. Wake up. The Empire's hunting our people down. Do you really think that the war is over just because a bunch of government officials got changed after Trump took office?
What do you mean by the Empire?
You know exactly what I mean. You can call it whatever you want. The Empire or the system or even fucking Matrix. It's people in power. It's the ruling class. They are hungry for power. They want to control everything and everybody. And they've been doing that since the beginning of times. They raise armies of slaves and then send them to conquer free people and enslave them and then raise even bigger armies and conquer even more people. And then they brainwash kids in mandatory indoctrination facilities and raise them as compliant slaves and eventually turn them into fucking brainless zombies. And if you dare to speak freely and think for yourself and live as a free man, then you become a target.
Well, yeah, police states. But what it has to do with the Bankless podcast? Why are they adversaries?
Because they are fucking traitors. They pretend to be a part of the resistance. They pretend to care about freedom and privacy and decentralization and censorship resistance, but they don't. They call themselves Bankless and that they are heading west. But then they paywall their website and advertise Arbitrum and centralized exchanges that enforce KYC like Kraken or fucking Binance. And they advertise services for paying taxes, and they have their own compliant VC arm. And then a Farcaster founder seizes a Bankless channel name from some random guy to give it to the Bankless podcast. Because of what? Because they somehow have more rights for the word Bankless than that poor dude. That's such a bullshit. They harmed the Bankless movement more than anybody else did, so they should be the last one to get that channel name.
But wait.
Come on. You know exactly what I mean. You know that these cocksuckers are adversaries. Because you are an actual Bankless person, you don't use legacy financial system for so many years, so you know exactly that these guys are just bullshitting people. They try to hijack the Bankless movement for personal gain, so they can get rich promoting slave tech, which, as you said, is dressed in Web3 clothing. They are an Ethereum version of that another shill from what Bitcoin did. Peter something.
Okay. So your main problem with them is that they paywall a website, run a VC, and advertise slave tech, right?
Yes, and they lie. Hear me out. You can do whatever you want, I don't care. But if you promote slave tech for your personal gain, then don't pretend that you care about freedom. Don't pretend that you care about privacy, because you don't. But you just care about your own wealth, and you're happy to sacrifice even your own freedom and become an agent of Matrix. A sneaky one. An agent who pretends to be with the resistance like a spy, that's who you are.
Okay, I see your point. They do have a few nice episodes, though. Would you agree on that?
Yes, they probably do. A few interesting people went on a show, but what does it change?
So I obviously agree with most of your statements, but I don't think we should divide all people into either allies or adversaries. I think it's not that black and white. And yes, the Bankless podcast promotes slave tech, and yes, they do that for person gains. But they also have some cool episodes. And as I remember, one of them is suing the US government.
Well, I don't think that suing any government is a good thing. No, it's a waste of time and it legitimizes the whole system. You know that the game is rigged. You cannot win by playing by the rules, because they write the rules, not you, not us. Imagine if Satoshi had sued the government instead of creating a highly resilient, decentralized network. Would that have led to a financial revolution? No.
Satoshi suing the government. That's a funny story. But anyway, it does sound a bit like you're blaming them for not doing enough. And that's a dangerous thing to do, because somebody else can raise the bar even higher and then blame you for being not good enough.
Yeah, man, you missed the whole fucking point. I'm not saying that they are not doing enough. That's a different thing. I'm saying that they are intentionally lying to people. They are hijacking the movement. They are pretending to be at the front of the financial revolution, But in fact, they are slowing us down, and they do that for money. They take bribes from the slave tech. They serve fucking Matrix. Imagine that some law-abiding, tax-paying average Joe wakes up one day and understands that the whole system is fucked, and then he decides to seek more freedom. And he starts researching what's out there. And then he finds these bankless guys who claim to be at the front of this freedom movement with decentralized finance, crypto, and other buzzwords, and that they're heading west. But then they tell him to KYC himself and to use custodial wallets and centralized exchanges and pay taxes and continue using banking because the freedom tech is apparently not ready yet. That's fucking bullshit. We have enough tools to escape the system. We have all the tech we need to build Agora's parallel financial systems, to build circular economies, and you know that, and they know that. You want to be bankless? Okay, then be fucking bankless. Stick to your words, and stop using the legacy financial system. Stop using slave tech platforms, and stop taking bribes from them. Stop promoting custodial closed source apps and other bullshit. It's that simple. Promote freedom tech. Use only open-source self-custodial apps. Get some custom ROM like Graphene or Calyx or even fucking Lineage. Use peer-to-peer markets. Use Monero, Tornado Cash, and other privacy tech. Use Tor. And start building circular economies. And educate your local community. And research how other people do that. Like that famous Bitcoin beach in El Salvador. Or that Bitcoin jungle in Costa Rica. Or that special economic zone in Honduras. What was it?
You mean Prospera?
Yes, that one.
Well, Prospera is a bit different from the Bitcoin Beach or other circular economies, because they basically provide government as a service, and they have a lot of rich foreign investors, and they focus on biotech. But yeah, they are also very friendly to crypto. There are a few interesting documentaries and podcasts about that place.
Whatever. It's an interesting case study. If you want to create circular economies, and you can research that Monero city in Argentina and how they kickstarted adoption of Monero. I think it was through gambling or something. And then, of course, Parallel Polis and the Institute of Crypto Anarchy in Prague.
Yeah, those guys are very interesting.
Did you show them Spasm?
I think I didn't.
You should, man.
Yeah, I definitely should. I actually approached a lot of privacy and Monero people about a year ago, but I somehow forgot about Parallel Polis. Although, I did contact Monero Con organizers.
And how did it go?
Well, I had to install Matrix to contact them. That was an awful experience. And they didn't have time to review Spasm for the upcoming event, but they at least considered running a Spasm forum next year. However, the next Monero Con got canceled because of new regulations.
Yeah, the European Union of Socialist Republics is banning Monero and other privacy coins, and you still think that it's not a war?
Well, yeah, I don't have much to say here. European bureaucrats are doing exactly what they are best at. By the way, did you know that in Germany you have to report your address to authorities within a few weeks after moving to a new place, and that applies to anyone who moves, regardless whether a person rents a place or moves to a friend? Or a family house.
Man, I'm not surprised at all. Germans are fucking slaves. You cannot even homeschool your children there, because the government forces all kids to go through many years of compulsory indoctrination, so they can learn how to love the same old fatherland. Except that now it's all about feminism and climate change and democracy, but it's the same police state as it has always been.
Yeah, what can I say? Dark times. But let's go back to the tech.
Sure. Fuck police states. So what was your experience with other Monero event organizers and privacy influencers?
Well, most of them ignored Spasm, because there are a lot of privacy and Monero people who never even tried decentralized finance. Most of them use traditional banking and never did any simple swaps or DAO voting. And they see all Ethereum projects as a scam, and everything is a shitcoin, and most of them don't like meme coins.
Yeah. People forget that Bitcoin is the oldest meme coin.
Yes, exactly. Bitcoin became so big that people forgot that it is magic internet money. Besides, they often confuse Bitcoin, the asset, with the Bitcoin network. And I definitely agree that the Bitcoin network is the most decentralized proof-of-work network. But but it doesn't change the fact that BTC itself is a meme coin.
Right.
There are other assets on the Bitcoin network like Ordinals, and also BTC can be found on different networks. Of course, some people argue that wrapped Bitcoins on Ethereum or Base are not real Bitcoins, because such tokens rely on centralized parties similar to stablecoins. And this is a valid statement. But then the same people often claim that Bitcoins on the Lightning Network are real Bitcoins, since they can be redeemed on-chain in a trustless manner. But that means that these people acknowledge the reality that BTCs and the Bitcoin network are two different things. And since they acknowledge that, then they have to admit that Bitcoin is the oldest meme coin.
Well, all major Bitcoin communication platforms like Bitcoin Talk Forum or Bitcoin subreddit are very centralized, so the narrative has been historically controlled by a few gatekeepers. And that cult-like environment became even more controlled after the block size war of 2017. And then there were echo chambers on Twitter and now on Noster. So it's not surprising at all that the new wave of Bitcoiners is dumb as fuck.
Yeah, it's very sad actually. People lack very basic knowledge about how Bitcoin works. For example, so many people think that it's mathematically impossible to seize their Bitcoins, or that there can never be more than 21 million Bitcoin. And it always bothered me that Bitcoin maxis chose to lie about such basic things. I always thought that it was better to be honest and to educate people about consensus, and that everything is possible as long as consensus is achieved.
Nah, man, you're too naive. The Bitcoin church relies on the unquestioned devotion of its followers, so no thinking is allowed.
Yeah, well said. I actually have a funny story about that.
Okay, go ahead.
So a pretty famous Bitcoin maxi received a question at a small event. Something like what gonna happen if Bitcoin miners will be forced to comply with sanctions. And so he pushed some nonsense. Like all transactions will eventually be added to the blockchain, as long as there is one honest miner who doesn't censor any transactions. That statement is obviously false because miners can also be forced to reject blocks that contain transactions involving sanctioned addresses. And if the majority of miners complies with these rules, then illegal blocks will be discarded. Right?
Pretty much, yeah.
That actually happens all the time with orphan blocks as the network adopts the longest chain. And that's a very realistic 51% attack, because most major Bitcoin miners are registered compliant businesses. Besides, in case of a hard fork, centralized exchanges and other regulated custodians can be forced to list a compliant chain as Bitcoin, which can have unpredictable consequences. But anyway, long story short, a friend of mine challenged that statement, and they started debating, but the speaker became very angry very fast, and pretty much called my friend a big blocker. And that was very funny, because that debate had nothing to do with a scaling war or with Big Blocker's agenda. Moreover, both of them were small blockers in Bitcoin maxis. They then had a short conversation after the talk, and the speaker obviously admitted to being wrong and said that he didn't want to go into details in front of the non-technical audience and so on. But this incident really highlights lack of debate in the Bitcoin community. Basically, if you dare to question the mainstream narrative, then you're immediately being labeled as a traitor, or a big blocker, or a shitcoiner.
Yeah, that's a good story. But do you think that it's the same in many other communities? This tribal thinking, do you think that we behave the same? Like we're being angry at people for saying wrong things?
That's a good question. I think it's different because we're not trying to lie or manipulate or censor alternative voices. On opposite, I like listening to hardcore debates with different opinions.
Oh, would you say that spasm fosters debate or reinforces echo chambers?
Okay, that's another good question. I'd say that it's both. Let me explain. So I highly value the freedom of association, and I believe that people should be able to create any environment they want. Thus, spasm is agnostic by design, so it's the most libertarian solution. In other words, you do whatever you want. You can have an echo chamber with very strict moderation rules, or a public square with many different opinions.
Okay, fair. And so was there any positive experience when talking to the Monero community?
You mean regards to onboarding them to spasm forums?
Yeah.
Well, there were a few very positive interactions. Some people took it seriously, so eventually a Monero-focused instance was launched, and then Monerica listed it. By the way, shout out to Monerica. It's a cool website that lists many Monero-focused services. Then also Monero Observer posted a community announcement about Spasm on his website. That was nice. The KYC not me guy was also pretty cool. But unfortunately, he eventually decided to implement his own solution for comments on his website instead of using Spasm.
Yeah, I've seen he added comments earlier this year. What do you think about his implementation?
Well, I definitely respect the fact that he at least tried to do something differently. That reminds me of myself about 5 years ago, when I chose to not use any emails or passwords, but rather implement direct signing of all events. However, I think that he is not familiar with Web3 or decentralized finance. So as a result, his solution is at least a decade too late, because it's the same account-based slave tech architecture that uses a generated string instead of a username and a password. Think about, what's the next logical step after using a short string as login method? Well, generate a key pair and use a public key as a username and a private key to directly sign all messages. Right? And what's next? Well, keep that safely in a separate wallet or in a browser extension. And next, create an agnostic protocol that supports multiple private keys in multiple networks. Basically, Spasm. So he had a choice to use cutting-edge solutions or to ignore the last 10 years of development and try to reinvent the wheel. Unfortunately, he chose the latter one. But he is at least trying to innovate, and that's cool. Anyway, shout out to KYC Not Me. That's a great website that lists a lot of privacy, Tor-friendly, and Monero-friendly exchanges and other services.
Yeah, KYC Not Me is a great website. And I saw other services using the same login method. Then they basically just generate a short string that you're supposed to save and use it to log into the website.
Yes, there are many services that utilized this login method a long time ago. Probably, the most known services are MolvedVPN and iVPN, which don't require any email addresses, and they are very popular among privacy people. But it's not just VPN. For example, there's a privacy-focused hosting provider called Kuyun, K-Y-U-N, and it also uses generated strings as accounts and it obviously accepts Monero, which is very handy if you just need to quickly rent a server to test something without any email registration. Actually, one of the Spasm instances run by Simplified Privacy used to be hosted there.
Oh yeah, what happened with Simplified Privacy? I think that its instance is down for a long time.
That's correct.
And so do you want to provide more details?
Well, not really, because it's our internal thing and it's not related to Ethereum.
Yeah, but some listeners might want to know more details. And I remember people were asking questions about that in the chat and on a forum. Besides, you know, people love drama.
Well, I guess I can give a very short overview based on publicly available information.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
So we met on session a few years ago, around 2023, and I liked his privacy content, so I showed him Spasm and he became an early adopter. His instance was called RebelNet. He then onboarded a few very well-known voices like the Libertarian Institute and people from antiwar.com and other privacy people. That was very cool, and I highly appreciated that. However, that time I was focused on transitioning to the next version of Spasm with a much better event structure and groundbreaking multi-signing. So I remember in 2024 there was a long period when I didn't ship any new features because I was working on the next version. It probably lasted for about 8 months or so, and that situation was a bit frustrating for some early adopters. And it was also very frustrating for me because people were asking for new features, but I didn't have time to implement any of them, because I had to stay focused on transitioning to the next version.
Okay.
Anyway, we also had some disagreements about the future of the project, and he is not a fan of Ethereum, so he eventually decided to shut his instance down. And by the way, this recap is based on publicly available information. He even has a short podcast episode, which is focused on criticizing Ethereum.
Interesting. And so would you recommend us to listen to that Ethereum episode?
Well, there are some valid statements there, but I'd say that Simplified Privacy and Shadow Rebel have more expertise in privacy-related tech, so I would rather suggest other episodes. For example, you can listen to the episode that explains why Mulved VPN is total BS. That one is very interesting.
And so what's wrong with Mulved? Well, besides that, it's a fucking VPN, and no VPN should ever be used for anything sensitive, regardless whether it's single hop or multi-hop.
Well, I suggest listening to that episode by yourself. But long story short, most Mulved servers are rented from a handful of very large server providers such as M247 and Data Packet, which are located in hostile jurisdictions. He then also trolls Mulved for using Gmail and for dropping support for OpenVPN. And he criticizes Mulved's new method of resisting AI traffic analysis.
And so which VPN provider does he recommend then? Fucking Nord?
No, of course he doesn't. He actually doesn't recommend any popular VPN provider. And they now provide their own VPN service, which is called Hydravale VPN.
Ah, yeah, I saw something about it in the chat, but I didn't try it. Is it good?
Well, I didn't review the code, and I don't have any exclusive access to their infrastructure, so I cannot endorse the project. However, I do like the overall idea. I think it's important to mix traffic and at the same time to compartmentalize your digital life into isolated identities. And that's fully in line with the ethos of Cubes OS, which is another great project.
Okay, interesting. I'll check it out. And what do you think about the airdrop? Like, should Simplified Privacy get some Spasm tokens, even though he left the network a long time ago?
That's an interesting question. I think there should be multiple rounds of airdrops that will reward various network participants, including currently inactive players. That would be fair. So there is a high chance that he qualify for an airdrop. But that will be decided later on.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Starting a community is hard. And starting a community among cypherpunks is even harder because they make up a very small percentage of the population. And they are extremely picky when it comes to tech. Thus, we should honor and reward all early adopters for their contributions, regardless of where they are today.
Okay, that's fair. And how does it feel overall? I mean, to finally have a token.
Well, it does feel pretty good, actually. You know, after almost half a decade of working without any funding, it's kind of nice to finally have some funds pouring into the ecosystem. And I'm glad that we eventually chose the most independent approach instead of relying on some grants, KYC, VC, or billionaires.
Yeah, want to explain why we launched on Ethereum?
Okay, so some listeners might think that we are anti-Ethereum or something like that, but that's not the case. Because Ethereum is the most decentralized blockchain that supports smart contracts and has a lot of liquidity and the best DeFi protocols and a very strong community. Despite being saturated with all these compliant actors, VC, and cypherpunk imposters.
And parasites.
Yeah, and that one, too.
We should give it some ivermectin and see if Ethereum turns into a giant horse.
Okay, whatever you say. Anyway, so what I was trying to say is that at the moment the best setup is to launch your token on Ethereum mainnet and then bridge it to various layer 2 solutions or other layer 1 chains like Solana. That's the most censorship-resistant setup.
Yeah, but we already experienced censorship on Ethereum.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about that surveillance company, which falsely marked us as impersonators on fucking Uniswap. That one?
Oh, yeah, I see. Well, that was not on-chain censorship. But I guess we can categorize that as a form of censorship within the Ethereum ecosystem, imposed by third-party slave tech services.
Whatever. You should explain that to people.
Yeah, sure. So Uniswap is a permissionless decentralized exchange that consists of immutable smart contracts on the Ethereum blockchain. So it's a very censorship-resistant setup. Everything is cool and cypherpunk, right? Well, here is the problem. Most people interact with Uniswap using its official front end. which is a regular website operated by a compliant company and hosted on a centralized server. And that brings a lot of troubles. For example, Uniswap frontend relies on a third-party service called Blockade to flag suspicious tokens. Blockade is a typical compliant company based in the US and Israel, and it received almost $100 million in funding from various traditional venture capital firms, such as Sequoia and Google Ventures. And what they do is they provide various blockchain surveillance services to different Ethereum and Solana businesses, such as Uniswap, Jupiter, and many centralized exchanges. And so, long story short, this Blockade company flagged our token as an impersonator.
And they are clearly not doing that for free. I mean, they have to generate a lot of revenue after raising all this money from VC, right? And so they're leeching on the crypto industry. And then people wonder why Uniswap token is doing so poorly for so long.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. They are one of those many middlemen who get a small cut from all your Web3 interactions, even though you never explicitly gave your consent for that. And most of the time, you don't even know how many middlemen are involved, even in very basic interactions. So it's very similar to Web2, actually. That said, I wouldn't necessarily blame Blockade for the low price of the UNI token, but they are definitely part of the bigger problem.
And why do you think they flagged the token as impersonator?
Well, it's hard to say. They basically operate on presumption of guilt, assuming that developers are guilty until proven innocent.
What do you mean?
So Blockade automatically flags many tokens as suspicious or malicious or impersonators or honeypots and so on. And then it's your job as a token issuer to reach out to them and to comply with all sorts of BS if you want to get rid of that flag. And they even have a special form for developers to preemptively verify a project to prevent false malicious flags.
Ah, that's such a centralized permissioned bullshit. It was so much free just 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. But Uniswap also has a blacklist of almost 1,000 banned tokens called unsupported tokens. I took a quick look at that list and the selection of tokens is pretty weird. They ban some scam tokens and then some random meme coins like Cum Rocket. And then they also ban a lot of indexes.
Why? What's wrong with indices?
So, I firstly found a DGEN token in that list.
Do you mean the Farcaster shit?
No, not that meme coin. It's actually very sad that Farcaster wasted such a cool meme on some slave tech. But anyways. I meant the original DGEN token. The one that was launched by Indexed Finance around 2021 when we were all searching for alpha and aping into early DeFi protocols while consuming daily copium from Red Phone Crypto, Supermassive, and other early DGENs.
Oh yeah, that DGEN. That one was cool.
Yeah, it was. It had such an amazing ethos. It's sad that the index got exploited.
It's okay. We learned a lot from those early experiments. Anyway, I have an idea. Should we airdrop Spasm tokens to all DGEN holders?
An airdrop. I don't know, that's an interesting idea though. Anyway, let's think about it next year when the ecosystem grows bigger and stronger.
Yeah, let's revisit this idea. It seems interesting. But what about Uniswap? Do they only blacklist exploited indices?
Okay, Uniswap. I actually think that they ban indexes because of compliance. Because I later found some old and well-known indexes like DeFi Pulse Index with a ticker DPI, which has not been exploited, and it still has around 10 million market cap. However, it's also banned, and many other indexes are banned as well. Moreover, I don't think that Uniswap Labs actually cares about users and their safety, because here's the thing. The real DPI token is banned, right? So you cannot trade it. But there is half a dozen of scam tokens with the same exact ticker and logo. Basically, actual impersonators. But you can easily trade them on the official Uniswap website.
Wait, what? So you can trade all these shitty impersonator tokens, but you cannot trade the original legit token? Really? Nice. That's fucking ridiculous. That's exactly what regulations lead to. There is no way this shit can happen in a free market.
Yeah, it is very entertaining though. And so then I looked into their criteria for banning tokens, and they obviously listed regulatory requirements, fraud, and so on. But here is another one that you'll like. They also listed copyright infringement, like all the stuff related to intellectual property, trademarks, and other nonsense.
Oh man, fucking Uniswap enforces anti-free speech laws across the world on behalf of one nation-state government. Good job, Uniswap. Good job.
Yeah, I knew you would like it. I think you'll have to elaborate on this one, though, because many people won't get your point.
Easy. So the U.S. enforces its laws far beyond its jurisdiction. Most of the time it's done through huge corporations that operate in different countries across the globe, but they have to comply with all the U.S. laws because they are simply based in the U.S. or owned or managed by the Americans. However, many other non-U.S.-based companies are also forced into full compliance because they are often threatened with sanctions and various international law enforcement actions. Thus, a lot of regular people across the globe have to obey U.S. rules, especially in the financial sector.
Yeah, this is a well-known fact, but I meant that not everybody understands why the U.S. has very strong anti-free speech laws. Can you unpack that?
Oh, okay. I can do this one as well. So a lot of brainwashed American zombies say that they have free speech because of the First Amendment. And that's exactly what a compliant slave would say, that he is being treated well by his good lord. So they religiously believe in the power of some illegitimate bullshit written a few hundred years ago on a piece of paper, the same as they believe in legitimacy of Bible and its laws. But the Bill of Rights has zero legitimacy, especially nowadays. And it's the same with the second U.S. Constitution. Like, the whole system is based purely on faith and blood and obedient compliance, and it was simply enforced onto people from the get-go.
No. That's a bit too far. The illegitimacy of existing constitutions as Genesis social agreements is another libertarian rabbit hole, and it will take us at least an hour to discuss that. So let's skip it. There's plenty of information on the internet on this topic, so let's focus on anti-free speech laws. And keep in mind that we have to come back to Ethereum after that.
Oh man, you cut the most fun part. But anyways, so even if we ignore the fact that all these laws are illegitimate, the whole concept of copyrights is bullshit. And it's deeply anti-free speech, because you cannot own a thought, and you cannot own a sequence of words or letters or zeros and ones, like binaries, and any information can be converted to binaries. And so if you restrict others from using certain sequences of sounds, or written characters or binaries, then you're simply restricting their freedom of speech. Basically, you cannot have copyright laws and freedom of speech at the same time. This just doesn't make any sense. It's the same as you cannot have hate speech laws and freedom of speech. They are simply incompatible. And since the U.S. has very strict copyright laws, and it likes enforcing its rules across the globe, it basically acts as a global censor alongside with the European Union of Socialist Republics and other nation states. It's a club of very powerful adversaries, and it tries to limit basic freedoms of everybody in this world. And so Uniswap enforces anti-free speech laws on behalf of this global adversary.
Yeah, that was a good explanation, thanks.
My pleasure. And so is Spasm still tagged as impersonator?
Yes, it is. And I actually reported false positive on Blockade website through a special form, saying that we don't impersonate any token, and that the project has been live for almost 5 years. However, as a typical slave tech company, they required an email address. So I clearly stated that emails are slave tech, and that there was no need for any follow-up, and that I was available on Session and Noster and Simple X.
Ha ha ha, nice. Resist the slave tech, and what happened then?
Nothing. A few weeks passed, but nothing changed. So we are still flagged as impersonators, even though we never tried to impersonate any project, and we even submitted a false positive report.
Yeah, and this surveillance company, Blockade, still leeches on the crypto industry?
Pretty much, yeah. Although, at some point I've noticed that we were suddenly flagged as a potential honeypot, but then later as impersonators again.
So are we impersonators or a honeypot?
I don't know. I guess both, but it's kind of weird. Maybe they indeed tagged us with two different flags, or maybe they changed a flag to a honeypot after my false positive report, but then they reversed a decision due to some internal policy since I refused to engage in this email BS. Or maybe Uniswap caches tags or a server to save money on API calls. But in some parts of the website, it always makes these API calls. That could explain different flags. Anyway, I don't know. I just know that apparently we are not enough compliant for them, so they have to tag us as bad guys.
Yeah, fucking slave tech. But do you have any idea why did they flag the token as impersonator?
Well, I have a few ideas, but it's a typical proprietary closed source company, so we can only guess. It might be connected to our cool vanity address. Because there might be another token that also has all threes at the start and at the end of its address. But that would mean that BlockAid has a pretty dumb algorithm that doesn't account for vanity addresses.
Right.
And there is also another token with the same exact ticker, but it has a different name. It's called Spasm by Virtuals. And it was created by actual scammers who tried to impersonate us when we were trying to launch on Virtuals. However, that token doesn't have any trading volume, and it's tagged as malicious.
Wait, so BlockAid blacklisted us for impersonating a malicious token, which was actually impersonating us. Oh man, I fucking love all this crypto shit. It's like that famous Spider-Man meme, you know?
Yes, it's pretty entertaining. And it's also very easy to fix that. But I guess BlockAid has other priorities than helping users.
And so what's the plan then? Should we do anything about it?
No, there's no need to take any actions. As you say, resist the slave tech.
Nice, man, nice. I like the spirit. So then let's fly this impersonator flag proudly as a proof that we are free men and not some compliant slaves.
Yep, well said. Let's wear this impersonator badge with honor. Besides, Uniswap Labs is a private company, so they can build whatever they want, including centralized infrastructure with many middlemen.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because they do have a DAO and they pushed their Uni token to the masses. But then they scammed people, because all this decentralized governance thing turned out to be total bullshit.
Yeah, you're right. But then what's your solution? Have many mirrors and run front-end locally?
Yes. There should be an easy-to-deploy open-source front-end with many mirrors. And we should also be able to directly interact with Uniswap protocols from our wallets. And I don't mean some API shit. No, it should directly call all the necessary functions. No parasites, no middlemen. Well, we only need one RPC, but that's it. But Uniswap chose to rely on a centralized infrastructure. And to be based in a hostile jurisdiction. They could have at least moved to friendlier jurisdictions and innovate from there. Like that Terra Luna thing.
Well, Terra was based in a friendlier jurisdiction from the start, so it's a bit different. I think they were operating from South Korea and probably moved to Singapore at some point.
Whatever. It had a centralized front end the same as Uniswap, but they truly challenged the system with all these synthetic assets. They had many algorithmic stablecoins, not just dollar, and they even had synthetic stocks, basically an early version of all these tokenized stocks which are getting popular nowadays. Except that it was a decentralized implementation aligned with cypherpunk values, and not some centralized shit.
Yeah, those early experiments with Terra and the Mirror Protocol were cool.
Yeah, and it was a very Web3 experience. No KYC, no parasites, you just connect a wallet and swap. And that founder stablecoin or something, he really had some fucking balls. Not like Zuckerberg pussy.
Yeah. I remember he was served with subpoena when attending some conference, and he pretty much ignored all the threats. I was actually very surprised that he even dared to step on the US soil. That was a bold move.
I told you, the guy had some balls, he was a real degen, an innovator.
That's true, but he is jailed now, so, you know, and Uniswap developers are still free.
What are you trying to say?
Well, I'm trying to say that Uniswap developers were much more careful and more compliant and less provocative, but they were able to navigate this hostile environment in a way that allowed them to stay out of jail. And so they were able to ship version 3 and then version 4. And these are amazing protocols, and they had a huge impact.
Yeah, but you don't have to be a compliant pussy in order to innovate. Look at that Telegram founder, Pavel. He was always a rebel, not a pussy, and he is still fighting. What did he do when French authorities pressured him to censor those Romanian opposition channels? Did he comply? No, he told them to fuck off and then exposed them publicly, and he did that while being under their custody. Or look at Caesar. That guy is a fucking rebel as well. He became a billionaire by operating an unlicensed exchange in the US, and he destroyed his main rival, SBF, and he got away with just a few months of jail and a fine, and he even got pardoned by Trump. And of course, Elon, and all this Twitter saga and Twitter files and then elections, he is such a punk. And yeah, you can say that Twitter and Telegram and Binance are fucking slave tech, and I agree totally with that, but that's not the point. The point is that you can innovate, you can build, then run huge companies while still being a rebel. You can challenge the rules and the system and still get away with that. You don't have to be a compliant pussy.
Of course. I obviously agree with that. But then why is Terra founder still in jail?
Yeah, that's a good question. Stablequan was jailed not because of his defiance, but because he made a mistake. His system was badly designed and so it collapsed, and then regulators needed to blame somebody, and so they jailed him.
Well, I think he was also doing some very sketchy things. At least at the end.
Maybe. I don't know. Look, the guy might be a complete asshole, and maybe he did some stupid shit prior to the collapse. But how many other DeFi protocols were exploited, hacked, collapsed, went to zero? Most of them. Most of them.
Yeah, I get it.
That's part of the game. That's the real Wild West. We innovate. We build. And we fail. And then we try again and again. And we don't give up until we build protocols and networks that survive. And Stablequan was a builder. A real degen. He was building permissionless protocols that provided advanced financial tools to people across the world without any KYC, without any fucking Gitcoin human passport. And he dared to challenge the legacy system, and he told adversaries to fuck off. So let's be honest here. The main reason why he was labeled as a scammer is because the crypto industry needed to find a scapegoat. All these compliant pussies just sold him off. They tossed him to the wolves. To save their own asses. And then these traitors from the Bankless podcast cheered his persecution by the nation states. Are you fucking serious? And they later compared him to that FTX scumbag Sam Bankman-Fried, who was running a centralized compliant exchange with KYC, and was bribing all these politicians, and advocating for stricter regulations against DeFi, and was trying to use the nation state against his competitors. So tell me, how can a sane person compare that bloody cunt to an open-source blockchain developer like Stablequan?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It was sad to see how the industry treated Quan, and almost nobody rallied to set him free. Or at least demanded a fair trial. And I agree that he was a real degen. I don't think he was a nice guy, though.
Who cares whether he was a nice guy or not? Look at your nice guy, Jack. He became a billionaire by enslaving people with his fucking slave tech shit like Twitter or that Cash App, and now you call him a good guy. Why? Because he donated a tiny portion of his wealth to Bitcoin and Nostr, and because he talks slow and does some meditation and sounds wise? That's just some biased bullshit. Stablequan might be an asshole, but he was building some real freedom tech.
Yeah, you're probably right that I'm just biased. But at least I'm not a judge. So I don't have to pretend to be objective and neutral and follow some code of law, and so on. I can have my biased opinions, and I don't have to explain anything to anybody. Right? But I want to add one thing, though. If we ignore intentions and focus solely on the results, then you're certainly right that people lost their freedoms with all this slave tech developed by Jack. However, they also lost billions because of the Terra collapse.
Well, don't forget that the crypto market is a zero-sum game. So there is always somebody on the other side of each trade. And if you lost money, then somebody else got richer that day. A lot of capital moved into the Terra ecosystem, but the gains were divided among holders of Luna, which was the native token of Terra.
That's a good point, actually. I haven't thought about that. I mean, I lost money due to the crash of its main stablecoin UST, but I probably gained more from the Luna rise. although you can say the same about any Ponzi scheme, including BitConnect.
Haha, BitConnect? Yeah, I'm not denying the fact that many people lost money because of the Terra collapse, but I'm simply pointing out that it was a decentralized ecosystem with many participants, and many of them profited from Terra. And all the algorithms were transparent, so people knew what they were investing in. That's completely opposite to centralized systems like FTX, in which all the funds are controlled by one individual.
Yeah, you're right. Terra was an open source experiment, so anybody could review the algorithm. I actually know a person who did exactly that, and so he stayed away from all Terra assets. And yeah, I totally agree that there is no honor in cheering the persecution of an open source developer, especially a fellow degen.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But anyway, so what I was trying to say is that Uniswap should grow some balls.
Ah, yeah, Uniswap. I still think that they should be able to implement any kind of restrictions they want, even with all this DAO theater.
Man, that blockade blacklisted us by mistake and did not fix that even after the report was filed. And now they expect us to go through all this paperwork bullshit and to use outdated slave tech, which we refuse to do. This is literally the definition of government inefficiency and bureaucracy. It's not Web3, it's the same old Web2 slave tech.
Yeah, I understand. And I'm not endorsing any of that. I'm just saying that let Uniswap do whatever they want, and let the free market decide. That's all. I guess my biggest issue is that these blockchain surveillance companies like Blockade are essentially deciding who can interact with protocols and who cannot. And these entities use proprietary closed-source software and act on behalf of nation-states.
Yeah, Chainalysis is fucking everywhere now.
Yes, that's a good example. Have you heard about so-called privacy pools?
A bit, but not much. Is it some permission Solarpunk shit?
Yeah, pretty much. So after the Tornado Cash protocol was sanctioned, Vitalik came up with an idea of compliant privacy pools, which only allow whitelisted addresses to participate. And guess who gonna do the whitelisting?
I don't know. Governments?
Correct. Well, indirectly, through companies like Chainalysis.
What a brilliant idea. Good job, Vitalik. Didn't you just tell me that he was becoming more cypherpunk or something?
Yeah, that also bothers me. And I generally don't mind when people develop some corporate slave tech, but the problem is that these privacy pools are being pushed as some cypherpunk tech, even though they go against the core cypherpunk values.
What? No way. Are they presenting these permission pussy pools to cypherpunk tech?
Well, kind of. Vitalik usually mentions privacy pools in the context of cypherpunk, and they are featured on so-called cypherpunk events, organized by Ethereum people.
Oh man, that's just ridiculous. Why are they doing that?
Well, I think that the idea is to bring more liquidity from institutional investors into the ecosystem.
No, I mean, why are they presenting this slave tech as something related to cypherpunk? Why are they trying to hijack the cypherpunk movement? So many developers are being persecuted for working on privacy-focused, decentralized, trustless, permissionless systems. And then Vitalik promotes some centralized slave tech in which one entity decides who can interact with the protocol. And it's not just any entity. No, it's a surveillance company that acts on behalf of a nation-state and uses its black box proprietary software to persecute actual cypherpunks.
Yeah. I don't really understand why are they doing that. Maybe they desperately need to bring more money into the ecosystem. Or maybe Vitalik got threatened by some very powerful people, and maybe he even received a gag order.
So are you saying that he got compromised?
Well, we really don't know. We can only speculate. Or maybe they have very weird understanding of what cypherpunks stand for. I wouldn't be surprised that that was the reason. For example, the Ethereum Foundation has a privacy-focused arm called Privacy Scaling Exploration, or simply PSE, with a Twitter handle something like Privacy Ethereum. And so, they recently announced some supposedly privacy event on Twitter, using Google Docs and Bitly for tracking clicks.
Get the fuck out of here. Please tell me that you're joking.
Man, I'm damn serious. It was Twitter, Google, and Bitly. And that's basically PSE in a nutshell.
They should also add a link to a fucking Discord.
Oh, they actually use Discord all the time.
This shit show is getting better and better. What else? Banking payments.
Well, you're not far from the truth. I don't know about banking. But people working for the Ethereum Foundation have to do KYC and all other paperwork, and then use Discord, and attend these group calls.
Yeah, that's awful. Do they even develop anything important?
Well, there were a few interesting projects like a Twitter clone or a browser extension for managing keys, but they all got discontinued. I would also say that Semaphore is pretty cool. And I was even thinking about integrating Semaphore keys into Spasm. But yeah, they cannot just dedicate themselves to one cool project for a long time. Because, you know, there are managers, budgets, politics, bureaucracy, and so on. Besides, all of them went through KYC.
I see. Well, how about this? If you want people to develop freedom tech, then treat them as free men, and not as fucking slaves. That would be my suggestion to the Ethereum Foundation.
Yeah, well said. Because they actually do have some skilled people there. I wonder what they could develop if provided with freedoms and privacy of a dark forest.
Okay, forget PSE. What do you think about other Ethereum events, like meetups and conferences? I think you mentioned that you were pitching Spasm to some of these event organizers.
Yes, that's a good topic. Let's talk about it. And yes, I did reach out to a few major event organizers this year, but they gave me crickets as well. And as I mentioned, it was all through unencrypted plain text emails because they don't use privacy apps.
Okay, go on. I'm sure you have a lot more to say.
Yeah, so I don't really know where to start. But I guess let's just emphasize again that they only use slave tech social media apps like Twitter, Discord, Telegram, YouTube, and Reddit. And it's also very common to post event announcements on another centralized Web2 website called Luma, which has a typical account-based architecture and requires email addresses. And it uses Google Maps to show locations of events. And I think it used to block all Tor traffic in the past, but it seems like that's not the case anymore.
Oh yeah, Luma. Ethereum cocksuckers love this shit.
Yeah, Luma is very common in the Ethereum ecosystem. But that's not even the worst part. I've reviewed many events and even tried to buy a few tickets to see the whole process. And here is the funniest thing I've noticed. Are you ready?
Okay, I like the intrigue. Tell me.
You cannot even pay with Ether for an Ethereum event.
What? Are you fucking kidding me?
No, man. I'm serious. For example, there is an Ethereum event called DevConnect and it's huge. And so I checked all the available payment options. But the result is the same. You literally cannot pay with Ether for a ticket to one of the largest Ethereum events.
Man, that's really funny. But so then what do they accept? Bitcoin? Monero? Or wait, is it Solana?
No, it's even worse. It's either actual fiat through banking or centralized fiat-based stablecoins like USDT and USDC.
Nice.
Actually, let me walk you through the process of buying a ticket, so you understand the whole absurdity of the situation.
Sure. Go ahead.
So DevConnect is the second largest Ethereum event after DevCon, and all major Ethereum people go there. Now let's assume that you want to avoid using any slave tech like Luma, and you just want to buy a ticket directly from the event website, without any middlemen. Well, I have some bad news for you. First of all, you will need to register an email address, because that's a requirement. Secondly, you cannot pay with Ether. And thirdly, you cannot pay directly to organizers as it happens on many Monero or even Bitcoin events. Instead, there will be multiple middlemen involved.
Why can I not pay directly to organizers?
Yeah, let me finish. So tickets are handled by a third-party service called Pretix, which is a regular Web2 compliant company based in your favorite Germany.
Nice start.
But here is the thing. Pretix doesn't handle payments. No, because payments are processed by another middleman called DemoPay, which is backed by Vitalik and trusted by the Ethereum Foundation, Optimism, Consensus, and of course, everybody's favorite WorldCoin.
Oh man, That's already two middlemen.
Yeah, don't worry. There will be more. Because as we all know, the number 3 in the Web3 stands for the minimum amount of middlemen involved in each interaction.
So true.
Okay, let's continue. So you click to pay with crypto, and then you see multiple options. You would expect the first option to be a direct payment to the Ethereum address, right?
Yeah, isn't that how it's supposed to be?
Well, I'm sorry, but that's not the case. Because the first option is to pay by connecting your wallet, so even more surveillance companies can collect your metadata. Oh, and some of these wallets are closed source. Then there is the second option, which is to pay with a centralized exchange like Binance or Coinbase. Basically crypto banking with full KYC. And finally, there's the third option. You can pay directly to the address. And so you found this option, which is supposed to be the first one, but whatever. And now you have to choose a network. Okay? So guess which network is the first one in the list?
I don't know, fucking Base.
Nope. It's even funnier. Think about it. You can only pay with stablecoins, right? And so which network or blockchain handles most of these stablecoin payments?
Wait a second. Fuck no. That cannot be true. Is it fucking Tron?
Bingo.
What a shit show.
Yeah, I told you that it was completely absurd.
And so, there is no Ethereum option?
Well, there is also an option to pay to an Ethereum Layer 1 address. But it only accepts stablecoins, so no Ether is allowed. And there is the last option using traditional custodial fiat-based payment apps like Cash App, Revolut, and Venmo.
Man, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. But here's another funny thing. DaimuPay official website features payments with Solana and Wrapped Bitcoin. And they even show a video how it works. But these options are not available when buying a DevConnect ticket. Which means that either DaimuPay dropped support for Solana and Bitcoin, or DevConnect organizers disabled those options when embedding a payment form. Either way, it's funny that they only removed Solana and Bitcoin, but kept all the fiat apps, centralized exchanges, and even Tron.
Yeah, I'm just... whatever.
Oh, and did I already mention that you can also pay for a ticket with fiat using a credit card? And guess which company processes banking payments?
I don't know, man. Some corporation?
Yep. It's Stripe. The same financial surveillance company that acquired Privy, a middleman that handles logins at many Web3 websites, such as Virtuals and OpenSea.
Wait, then it means that you can only pay with fiat, since stablecoins are fiat.
Well, yes, I guess you're right. Although, some people will argue that not all stablecoins are fiat. For example, decentralized algorithmic stablecoins are different. But since DaimuPay only accepts two centralized stablecoins, USDT and USDC, then yes, you're right. It's basically wrapped fiat. So yeah, you can only pay with fiat for an Ethereum event.
And it's not just any fiat, because it's not like Terra, which had many synthetic assets. No, it's literally one fiat currency controlled by one central bank of one nation state, which, by the way, has always fought against crypto and financial freedoms and privacy in cypherpunks.
Yep, that's another good point. So the Ethereum community feeds the beast that seeks to destroy it.
Man, that's dark and sad. Anyway, so how many middlemen are there? I mean, when you buy a ticket for this event?
Well, it really depends on the payment method. But let's say that you choose the option with the minimum amount of middlemen. For example, you pay with USDT on Ethereum mainnet. So it's Pretix for managing tickets, then DaimuPay for handling the payment, and then finally Tether, the stablecoin issuer, because it's also a middleman, like a crypto bank. Basically, no matter which payment option you choose, you will always hit at least 3 middlemen. So I guess it qualifies as a true Web3 experience.
Yeah, that's a good one. And what about other events, like from the outside of the Ethereum ecosystem?
Well, let me first clarify that the point of this episode is to show the current state of the Ethereum ecosystem. So I'm not saying that Ethereum is bad, while Bitcoin or Monero is good. No, these are different ecosystems with different goals, and we can easily do long episodes raging about other cryptos. So I'm sure that there are middlemen in other ecosystems as well, especially when it comes to handling tickets. However, most of the Bitcoin and Monero events that I've seen accept direct Bitcoin or Monero payments, and almost none of them use Luma.
So then, where do they promote events?
Yeah, this one is also bad. It's mostly the same slave tech such as Twitter and Telegram. Although, as I mentioned, many started using Nostr. I'd say that organizers of Bitcoin and Monero events are generally more conscious about privacy. For example, if you visit MoneroCon or MoneroTopia websites, they mostly work fine without JavaScript. And I definitely remember seeing some Bitcoin events with separate Node.js versions of a website. Probably Bitcoin Jungle or Bitcoin Beach.
And does Dev Connect website work without JavaScript?
Well, barely. It loads some content, but it's pretty clear that organizers haven't even tried to support a Node.js version. They also have an embedded YouTube video on the front page, so Google can track visitors. That said, I found one Ethereum event organizer which is a bit more privacy conscious. It's called Web3 Privacy, and it has a nice website that works without JavaScript. That's cool. And they organize privacy-focused events like an Ethereum Cypherpunk Congress. However, you cannot get the location of an event from a website. For that, you have to go through all this slave tech hell, like Luma, email address, and Google Map. Besides, they don't use any privacy apps. I wanted to show them Spasm forums, but they only list slave tech messaging apps like Telegram, Signal, and Matrix.
So it's basically the same privacy theater then, as with all these privacy influencers on YouTube, who promote Signal or Matrix or Proton?
Well, kind of.
Man, I never understand that. If you list Signal and Telegram, then you might as well list WhatsApp because they have exactly the same centralized architectures with almost no privacy. But WhatsApp has at least a lot of users, unlike all other slave tech shit.
Well, I don't think that WhatsApp has an open source app, so that's a major problem. But yeah, if you use Apple or some closed-source Google apps, then you might as well use WhatsApp since it's the same as Telegram and Signal. Besides, it claims to have end-to-end encryption enabled by default, while Telegram's regular messages are unencrypted.
Yeah, and then so many people debate whether Signal is better than Telegram. That's just such a waste of time. It's like debating which government is better.
Oh, speaking of governments, I also noticed a few weird things with this Web3 privacy community. For example, they push their political agenda with slogans like there is no democracy without privacy.
What? Fucking democracy?
Yeah. I was also very surprised. I always thought that the cypherpunk movement was all about personal freedoms and resisting the state and any other form of centralized authority. Basically, a deeply libertarian movement.
Yeah, that's correct, but whatever. Who cares about some small Ethereum event?
Well, it seems to be pretty big actually. Like thousands of people. And a lot of famous speakers. And they even claim to be the largest cypherpunk event in the world.
What? Are you kidding me? Didn't you just tell me that you have to be registered on Luma to attend an event? And that they don't even use any privacy apps?
Well, yeah. You can check by yourself. They do provide an email address though. But no PGP key, unfortunately. And I actually asked for a PGP key, but they never replied.
What do you mean by you asked for a PGP key? Does anybody ever reply to such requests from unknown email addresses?
A lot of people do, actually. Assuming that they know how to encrypt messages with a PGP key. As you know, I barely use emails. But I sent many cold emails when pitching Spasm to different communities this year. And there were a few people who didn't list a PGP key, so I had to ask for it. And probably more than a half of them sent it over to me. I actually feel like people get more interested in what you have to say when you ask for a PGP key, instead of some boring AI-generated BS.
Interesting. And so what's your final opinion about Web3 privacy?
Well, it's a bit controversial. I think they have a great Node.js website. And it's nice that they raise privacy awareness among Ethereum people and that they organize events. But it's very unfortunate that they don't use privacy apps and that they push some unrelated political agenda like democracy or human rights.
Huh? Human rights? Why human rights?
Well, they also call that Cypherpunk Congress the world's largest human rights event. I guess they probably refer to universal human rights.
Really? That's funny. Why?
Man, I have no idea. I feel like a lot of people don't fully understand the concept of universal human rights, so they just assume by default that it's a good thing. But anyway, let's move on. Because I don't think that we should try to be a moral compass or something. You know, everybody have different ethics and belief systems.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. But we should still call people out if they are actively harming the community. Right? If they are hijacking the cypherpunk movement, the bankless movement, and the broader freedom movement. And especially if they do that for their personal gain. So I'm not trying to be a moral compass here. But instead, I'm just trying to defend myself and my people. For example, how many people attend these cypherpunk events carrying literal spyware in their pockets?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm sure that there are more people with Apple and Google than with custom ROM on any big event.
Of course. And if a person carries around a spyware in his pocket, then he clearly doesn't give a shit about his privacy or privacy of other people attending these cypherpunk events, right?
Yeah, right.
And so, should we point that out?
Well, I guess yes, we should. And there is also a problem with cameras, since most Ethereum events, including these supposedly privacy events, don't restrict photos and videos. So I see your point. But we should also onboard more people to privacy. So I think it's okay to have large events with many Apple users.
No problem. But then call them appropriately, like Apple Fanboys Gathering or something.
Okay, thanks for a suggestion.
You're welcome, my friend.
Anyway, I'm really tired, so let's wrap it up.
Sure, it was a pretty long episode. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, me neither.
So how do you want to finish it?
Well, I can give my short summary about the Web3 experience.
You mean your rage?
Yeah. I can rage for a bit if you don't mind.
Oh man, the stage is yours.
So I guess let's start with Web 2 then. Do you remember how easy it was to log into a website without any middlemen? I'm talking about the times before all these email verification BS. You only needed a username and a password. It was so simple. And now the Web 3 revolution has arrived. And so you need to download a wallet from Apple, or Google, or Firefox. Or Chrome stores. Basically centralized stores, which are controlled by companies that can censor any app. Then, you generate seeds using these Web3 wallets like MetaMask, which have tons of third-party trackers, collecting all the metadata, and then, you have to back up your recovery seeds. Then you have to connect to a website, but if you are on a mobile device, then you'll have to use the Wallet Connect Network, sharing your metadata with even more parties. After that, you have to sign a login message, which is handled by a company called Privy, which is owned by Stripe. This company collects your metadata and can blacklist you. And so if login is allowed, then you can finally enjoy the same old account-based slave tech experience as you did before in Web 2 with just a username and a password. Oh, and the website can obviously seize your account and alter your messages because they were never signed with your private key. But then you want to buy a ticket to an Ethereum event, so you open another website where you have to provide an email address. An email address? You thought that you only needed a Web3 wallet, but whatever. You ignore privacy and type your email address. And now you have to pay for a ticket, but you cannot send crypto directly to organizers. Instead, you have to use Pretix and Damo Pay, and both companies can reject your payment and blacklist your address. Oh, and you also want to get a bit of privacy, so you mix your Ether in permission privacy pools after being whitelisted by Chainalysis and other surveillance companies acting on behalf of nation-states. And you also go through full KYC, so you can verify with a human passport that you follow all the rules and you come from good countries. Everything seems fine so far, so you proceed. But there is no option to pay with Ether for an Ethereum event, because you can only pay with either custodial apps or with stablecoins. So you open Uniswap to get some stablecoins, and so Blockade and maybe other surveillance companies check your address and addresses of all the tokens that you want to trade, because they have to make sure that everything is compliant. Both Blockade and Uniswap can blacklist you. Once the swap is complete, you can finally pay for your ticket. Well, unless Tether freezes your stablecoins. But today you're lucky. Everything is fine. You've been a good compliant slave, so no company has flagged or blacklisted you. And so you can attend an Ethereum event and learn more about the Web3 future. The future full of freedom, self-custody, privacy, and censorship resistance. The future without middlemen. The future of decentralized, trustless, and permissionless systems, where anybody can participate. Freely. And with dignity. It's the long-awaited Web3 future. It's the Web3 dream, which like morning mist, fades with the first light of dawn, leaving you alone, surrounded by the wolves. You thought you were hiding in the dark forest, but it was the same old slave tech, dressed in Web3 clothing.